Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Not About the Weather. This is episode 16 of our little show, and we are joined today by a special guest to talk about a particular project. So we'll get to that in one moment. My name is Natalie, as you would know if listening to this podcast. If you are listening to this podcast by accident, I really don't know how you got here, but welcome. And my co-host today is Mitch Clow, who is, again, another one of our long-suffering team members.
Long-suffering. How astute.
So our guest today is an old friend of mine, actually, called Christopher Gutierrez, who is, he's a person who's done a lot of things, but he's here today to talk in particular about one particular thing that's happening, and we'll talk a little bit more about what he's done in a moment. But he's, he's had an interesting life in the world of music and pop culture and writing and doing self-made projects. So we'll get to that in one second. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on our Twitter account, which is NATW Podcast. You can also find us on that same handle at Facebook, Instagram, and if you want to email us into Gmail as well. NATWpodcast.com is the easiest way to find everything about all of the podcasts that we do under this little brand. It's really only two. It's this one and one other. Or if you want the actual archive of our shows, you can go to notaboutheweatherpodcast.com, which you can also follow as a Tumblr. Really, everything you could want is found through that first main link, NATWpodcast.com, if you start clicking buttons there. So we, as you would know, our general pop culture interest show about whatever we want to talk about currently. And we have a friend of the family on to talk about a project that we're doing today. Chris, I can definitely hear Shelley talking to the cats. Is that happening right now?
Really? That's crazy. Yes. She's in completely in the other room. Let me move.
Yeah, it's not that bad, and it's kind of thematic as well. But so Chris is a friend of mine. Chris is a self-published author who has had an interesting career doing many things before basically throwing off the shackles of a structured workplace to survive on the projects that he is able to do himself with the audience that he's gained through his work. And he has done a ton of things. So I don't know, Chris, do you want to give a very short summary of like your path from like people knowing who you are to here? Or do you just want to talk cats, or what do you want to do?
Let's do all of it. No, I guess I suppose a little background would probably help, you know, maybe your listeners make a little bit of sense of my life. But long story short, let's see, where to begin? I don't know. I started off as a young little punk rock boy in Chicago. No, I'm just kidding. basically, long story short, I have been involved in the punk and hardcore community in Chicago and for decades. I want to say probably the early 80s. So yes, I am an old dude. And from there, certain relationships blossomed. And I made a lot of friends early on because it was such a tight-knit community of punk rock and hardcore in Chicago. And so I made a lot of friends, and some of those friends went off to become fairly notable figures in the punk and hardcore and actually pop, you know, culture phenomenon. So I started a band. I used to write fanzines. And then I joined a band, and it was called Arma Angelus. And what people seem to have noticed, what really took notice of my writing, was when I started a band with members of Fall Out Boy. And early on, before they were Fall Out Boy, we broke up. They went on to form Fall Out Boy. We were all maintained that friendship, and they wrote a song about me. And people would say, well, who's this Chris guy that you guys are singing about? And there was a song called Grenade Jumper off of Take This to Your Grave. And they would say, who's this Chris guy you're talking about? And they're like, oh, it's our friend Chris. He was like our first fan. And so that kind of redirected some attention to my writing. From that blog, from my writing in the early 2000s, I gained a bit of a following. And I wanted to test that following to see how, you know, rabid they seem to be. You know, from what I could tell, I was getting about 20,000 at my height. I was getting about 20,000 hits a day, and so there was an online petition put together, asking me to put together a book because the stories that I would write on my blog at the time seemed to resonate with people. And so I put together a bit of a manuscript and shopped it around, and I gave it to literary agents, and everybody said, "This is garbage," because it was. And basically, it was my demo tape. And so I shopped it around. Everybody's like, "No, we're not going to put this out." Finally, I had a small independent publishing company that was going to put it out, but they kept dragging their heels on it, saying, "Well, we have to let you build more momentum. We need to figure out what's going on with you. It's going to be maybe next year." And I said, "You know what? I don't want to die and not have this thing, you know, a physical, you know, have a physical copy in my hand." So this was still in, you got to remember, this is still 2005 at the time. So self-publishing was not a big thing at that time. Now it's huge.
And even ebooks weren't a big thing. Oh, like you could self-publish an ebook in 12 seconds, you know, now. Like,
Yes. Yeah. And at that time, that was unheard of publishing things yourself. There weren't things like, you know, Lulu and all these different places where you can just easily upload a PDF and have a new book in your hands in, you know, 5 to 7 days. At the time, I had to source print shops and, you know, editors and graphic designers. And there weren't just like little places where you could, well, maybe there were, but I didn't know about them, where you could just be like, "I need a book cover. You know, this is what my book's about." And somebody was like, "Okay, we'll plug it into this template. And, you know, here's your semi-unique book cover." there weren't things like that at the time. So it was taking a huge risk. And at the time, funny side story, which we will have many tangents on this podcast, get ready. What I did was I was in a class action lawsuit with a former employer. I worked at a restaurant waiting tables, and I found out that they had been, well, they were number one run by the mob, the Chicago mob, which
Why?
Is that's how things go here. How about this? Even sub story to that, all the coin laundry in Chicago, in all of the apartment buildings, you know, you walk downstairs, there's
coin
laundry, are run by the mob and have been since the 80s.
Well, that's just like a business that they do.
Yes, it's a money laundering, no pun intended, but money laundering scheme for the mob. It's legitimate.
Really?
And it's been,
just...
Yes, because, and I know this only because my landlord, who owns 11 buildings, you know, over 1,000 units in Chicago, straight up told me. She's like, "Yeah, yeah, they've ran it since the mid-80s in almost every single building in Chicago." And I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." Anyways, so back to our original tangent. So I found out that the restaurant that I had been working for was scamming all of us. So basically every time there was a credit card transaction, there's a fee. Okay. Now, normally the restaurant pays that fee, but they were passing it off onto the servers. So the servers were paying that fee every single swipe. And on top of that, we were supposed to get a server wage, which is extremely low. Basically, it's to cover taxes because they think that you're just going to make all of your money in tips, which is generally how it works. So basically, you get paid $3.19 at the time in Chicago. But what they were doing was they were saying, "Well, you guys are allowed to eat, so we'll let you we let you eat breadsticks and salad. So if you can eat soup, salad, and breadsticks, well, we're going to charge you $2 an hour for every hour that you work." And we were like, "But we're not allowed to eat between the hours of 11 and 3 and 7 and 10. But you're still taking $2 an hour out of our measly $3.19 checks." And the problem was that they had a law student who was in their last year of law school. And they had... Am I allowed to swear on this podcast, by the way?
Yes, you are.
All right. I don't know.
Yes.
And so they were screwing over this guy, and he basically said, "You know what? Fuck you guys. I'm going to, you know, I know you guys are scared. Yeah, we're going to sue you." And so he basically took it to his law professor, and his law professor said, "Yes, you have a case here. We're all going to work on it." So they all got together, and they sued Leona's, who had something like 19 locations. They weren't just like some tiny little restaurant. They were like a huge force in Chicago.
Mm. What a fun school project.
And for real. And they won. And they sent me a check, and it was for over $1,000. And I literally screamed because at the time I was on welfare and I was getting essentially like food stamps at the time. And because I was making, I want to say something like I made $8,000 that year. I was barely even scraping an existence because I had just put myself through beauty school. And so I took that money. And instead of paying bills, instead of doing the responsible thing, I said, you know what? I'm going to invest that money, borrow $2,500 more from one of my best friends in the world and make a book. And then I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that people decide to, you know, actually support what I'm doing. And basically in December of 2005, I put out my first book, which is called On the Upswing of Life, Love, and Regret. And I ended up selling 1,063 copies in the first 3 months, which gave me, netted me probably about $16,000. And I got to pay everybody back. And what's great about that, to tie all of these tangents all back together, is that that was the first time that I realized that there was a community of people out there online that were there who were willing to be supportive in the creative endeavors that I had. And it was one of the turning points in my life. You know, when people like to say, like, what was a turning point in your life? And you say, well, I don't really know. Maybe this time, maybe this time. That was a definitive moment in my life where I realized that I might be able to make a honest and genuine living off of my art and know that there are a small but rabid fan base of people in this world who support what I do because they think that what I do is good, if that makes sense. And so basically that's started that whole thing. And so in 2005, I started the Dead Stop Publishing Company. And we have put out, I want to say, I should probably know this, 17 editions of 14 different books.
17.
Yeah. And 14 different books and by four different authors. And yeah. So we have sold, Dead Stop Publishing sold over 20,000 copies now. And through that, I started touring. I got somebody to help me with my US-based touring, and then I got somebody to help me with my UK-based touring, and then I met Nat. And Nat has helped me and guided me through 5 tours of her wonderful and amazing country of Australia. One place that I never in a million years thought I would ever end up. I'm like, oh, I'll never go to Australia. And I just found myself sending books to Australia constantly. And I was like, well, I mean, if there's a fan base down there, let's cross our fingers and fly halfway across the world and hope that somebody shows up. And when I landed, Nat was there. And she had been there every single time, all 5 tours, to ensure that I did not get eaten or die somewhere in some crazy, you know, I don't know, little town. But anyways, so yeah, and that leads us to where we're at now. I guess that's my background.
So it's interesting because what you're talking about, like, is something that we've recently had to do as well, in that our shows are not monetary. It's kind of like a hobby because we don't really have any friends and this is the only time we really talk to anyone. But this show that we're doing is an independent show and it is based on us. It is not based on talking about a television show. We're talking about a theme. It is based on people wanting to hear us on whatever we have to talk about, from them liking us from other shows or whatever for the past 5 years. That is really stressful for me because I hate ego, if you know what I mean. Like, I find that, like, so, like, how dare you? Like, how dare you think that people, like,
want to hear your opinion?
Yeah. And so that was, like, a really stressful thing for me that we've sort of been overcoming with doing this show and it having people actually be interested in it. So that's kind of weird, but yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, the way that I see it is that if it's, who is it? Like, who out there has the credibility to be like, well, you should listen to my opinion on anything.
Yeah, it's true.
Do you know what I'm saying? So why not you? And if you have some kind of unique insight or some, you know, interesting take on something, why not have a podcast and throw it out into the ether? And if people want to stick around, they will. And if they don't, they'll move on to something different. And that's how, you know, I mean, that's just the nature of our culture now, you know, how fickle people can be or how dedicated they can be. And I think that all has, you know, it's all testament to how much you can connect with people who listen to what you have to say.
So, yeah, so as Chris said, I have, booked events for him here in Australia for the past 5 years. It's a weird little part of my life as well, and that is something that has been, you know, a fun and strange occurrence. Oh, it's, you know, a year later, time for Uncle Chrissy to fly in and try to eat something off the street. Like, And no, but it's always good. But he has, you know, done many things in the time that I have known him, like many, many other projects as part of his kind of self-made career. Like he, for fun, decided at one point that he wanted to work out how to make vegan soap like they do at Lush. And he made some soaps and he sold them and people really liked them. And then recently in the last few years, when I first met Chris, he had two full-size vintage arcade games shoved in his living room, taking up space, which seemed normal and stuff. But in the last few years, he's been doing a weird side passion project, extra money situation of restoring and building arcade games for, you know, overgrown boys who want to have these in their house. Or, like, where else do you sell them to? Like, restaurants, like, places that want, like, a cool thing, like a lobbies for businesses and stuff? Is that the kind of places that usually get them?
Well, I mean, it's all across the board. Should I give you a little bit of history on this as well? Because, you know,
yeah,
I mean, to be a little long-winded.
In. So basically, we're it's all going to be tied in because what we're talking about today is a project that Chris is doing that combines one of his most recent projects, which is this arcade restoration, and also a charity project involving cats, which is the reason that Mitch is here, because he loves games and cats. And one, a big side note to Chris's life is that he is a crazy cat lady, and we've gathered some crazy cat ladies here today to talk about it.
Well, perfect. This is exactly where I need to be.
Here to support you.
Long story long, I've always needed some kind of project. I've always needed some kind of side hustle. Ever since I was a little kid, I would, you know, buy Transformers from other kids and then resell them. I was always trying to hustle. I was the bootleg video guy during
I was going to say, the tapes. Yeah, like, that's so
weird. I have this weird penchant for wanting to document things. And so when my mom got a video camera, like those big, the big VHS recording, you know, cameras back in the 80s. And I would take it to school with me. And I would record full days of high school, like, well, not full days, but like 2 hours of me in high school, which it sounds ridiculous, but you got to remember I'm old, right? Like, I'm an old dude now. So I graduated in 92. All right. I graduated high school in 92. So what's funny is that I found
Mitch,
this.
What year were you born?
I was born in 92.
There you go.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Awesome.
Sorry. I've known Mitch since he was like 17 or so.
Yeah.
18?
Yeah. 18, like,
anyway,
I think.
Yeah, carry on. Sorry, Chris.
So basically what I did was, you know, it sounds funny now, you know, like, oh, I recorded like 2 hours of high school. And yeah, if you just graduated high school, it sounds ridiculous. It's like, well, why would you do that? Who's going to want to watch that? Let me tell you, thousands of people. And I can tell you this for a fact because I uploaded it to YouTube. I converted it, uploaded it to YouTube. And now there are thousands of people who've watched this thing and they're all like, oh, my God. That's when my dad went to school. You know, that's where my dad went. Oh, my God. That's my high school now. Oh, my God. Everybody. And it's funny because my girlfriend currently is younger than me. Right. And she's 30. And so she watches it and she watched part of it. And she's like, you know what it looks like? She's like, it looks like everybody's walking around in costumes. It looks like everybody is walking around in a 90s costume. How they really were. And it's funny to watch and to see these hairstyles and the styles of people's clothing. And it's one of those things where I'm so glad that I documented it. And but I've always had this urge to do that. So around that time, I started videotaping hardcore shows, probably around 1991, 92 is when I started it. And I just would go to shows and, you know, just my friends' bands and whatnot, and I would start to record them. And then they started to open up for bigger bands. And I started recording those. And eventually I amassed this list of about 50 bands that I had recorded. And one of my friends came up to me and they said, hey, if I give you a videotape, will you tape some stuff for me? I was like, yeah, sure. And then all of a sudden his friend, like a friend of a friend, was like, hey, if I give you like $5, will you make the tape for me? And I was like, yeah. And then all of a sudden I started getting all these people hitting me up asking for this. And I was like, wait a minute, is this a thing I can do? So I made like 10 tapes. I remember I recorded like 10 tapes of bands. Just dubbed them and then put them in little stupid cases, right? That I made like paper covers for. And I went to a show and I was like, I'll try and sell them for $5 a piece, right? And because the videotapes were $1 at the time. And I sold out in like a matter of minutes. And I was like, well, this is a thing now. So all of a sudden, I was constantly recording bands. I would go to shows, like even shows I didn't want to go to. I would just sit there and I'd videotape the band. And then I started trading with people because there's this huge trading ring in the 90s. And I had amassed this collection of thousands of bands. And at the height, I think I was making over 20 grand a year just selling bootleg tapes. Yes, no joke.
Wow.
It was crazy because like all of a sudden music stores were like, yeah, we would like 250 tapes this month. This month they would slay, and I would sell them to them for $5 a piece wholesale if they would buy 100 tapes, and then they would sell them for $11. And so my bedroom at the time looked like this. I looked like some weird bootlegger because I was.
Yeah.
There was a stack of VCRs on top of each other, right? And there was one that played and then five that recorded. So that's how I would put out like this.
Were you living with your mother at this time?
No, not at all. Not at all. This is when I was in college and I was living with one of my best friends, Boo. And so I was always this guy who's always had to have a hustle, like always had a side hustle. And I was talking to a friend recently who had gone to a conference and they mentioned in it about how having a side business, no matter how small it is, but having a side passion is something that is essential. And for like, kind of like, I don't know, feeling fulfilled in your creative endeavors. It's something that you can control, regardless of whether or not you make money in it. And I was like, yeah. And they said, basically, it's a control issue, because in other aspects of your life where you don't feel like you have control, this is where you can, you know, ultimately have an outlet for your frustrations and your passions and be in control of it. And so I was like, huh, I wonder if that plays into that, because I feel restless when I don't have something, some creative thing, some creative outlet. And so that obviously tapered off because nobody bought videotapes anymore. And then I started writing. And in that writing, I, as Nat mentioned, I started making soap because I fell in love with what's it called? The one from Lush. Strawberry body soap from Lush. And I loved it. And then I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe they charge $30 a bottle for this crap. And so I was like, wait, instead of spending that, how do I make this? So basically, I started Googling a lot of things on how to make soap. And I kind of put together my own concoction of, I loved the smell of it, but it's not identical to it. So basically I started doing that and I basically made it for myself. And I kind of jokingly threw up like a few bottles to kind of test the waters on my website and my blog. And I was like, I wonder if anybody wants this. And all of a sudden people started buying it and they started buying a lot of it. And the problem with making soap is that it's not... It's not an easy process, and I just could not keep up with. And to be honest with you, the profit margin was so minimal; I was barely.
Is this when you were living at your old apartment? Which
the little basement apartment? Yes,
the one in the building when you're at now, yes. Or the other.
Yes,
there's not a lot of room in that for a soap business.
No, it really isn't. And so what's funny is that Nat has been to that tiny little apartment, and it was a studio apartment, and I want to say it was 250 square feet. It was very, very small, okay? As a studio apartment, I kept it nice and clean, but it was still a very small place. So this will come into play in a bit. So what I was doing is I was doing this little side hustle of making soap, and I loved it and it was fun. But the problem was that it started to grow a little bit too big for me. And at the same time, it's expensive to ship soap. You can't get a media rate on it. And especially over the past few years, the Australian, I'm sure Nat knows how expensive it is to ship anything to Australia now. And I just feel terrible awful. Like, I feel terrible that it costs more money to ship one book to Australia than it does to buy that book. So you can buy my books on my website for like $16 to $18, and it costs me $22.50 to send it to Australia. So it's very frustrating. So the soap thing kind of fizzled out just because it was basically a hobby. And then I had a Galaga. For those of you who don't know, it is a legendary old school 1980s arcade game. And I had gotten it for a birthday present from an ex-girlfriend in 96, 97. And it was my favorite game of all time. And she bought it for me. Long story short, about four or five years ago, I sold it. It was just sitting in my mom's basement because I didn't really have room for it. And I sold it and immediately regretted it. And so I went online and I was like, I wonder how much I could buy one for. And I was like, oh my God, they're so expensive, right? And so then I was like, well, wait a minute. I wonder how difficult it would be to make one. So I started Googling it, and there's huge, huge arcade communities of people who do restorations and do build. And so I started learning a lot from YouTube tutorials. I don't know people who know how to fix or make an arcade game. I'm not that guy. I don't have technical friends like that who's like, oh, yeah, the transistor is over here and the power source to this. And I have no idea. I don't know those people. And so I just went on YouTube, and that's the brilliance of YouTube, is that you can literally learn anything in the entire world, how to do anything on there. And so I started watching YouTube tutorials, and I bought an old crappy game, and it was super beat up, and they're sold as what are called projects. So they're called project games, which means that they're generally falling apart and need a ton of work, okay? And basically I learned how to slowly fix these games up and make them playable. And then I started learning how to make them look cooler. And so I made one just for me. And my friend came over and he looked at it and he's like, dude, do you want to sell me this? And I was like, wait, but for real? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay. And so I sold it to him and I was like, oh, that's cool. I'll just take this money and make another one. It was fun. So I built another one. And then somebody else came over and said, hey, I heard you sold that to that dude. I'm like, yeah. He's like, would you sell me this one? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, wait a minute, is this a thing again? So I was like, maybe I'll do another one. So I did another one and I threw it up online to sell, and it sold immediately. And then 35 games later, this is where I'm at. And so now I live in a second story in the same crappy building before, but I live on the second story with my girlfriend in a one bedroom. And you can't really lug giant arcade games up the stairs over here. And so what I've realized is that I wanted to learn how to make like a sit down Miss Pac-Man, like a proper cocktail table, sit down glass top Miss Pac-Man. And I went online again, did a lot of research, and that's what I did. I think 6 games ago was I made my first one. And I make everything from the ground up. Literally, I go to Home Depot and I buy a giant 8x4 foot piece of 3/4 inch MDF wood. And I have them cut it for me just into 4 pieces so I could fit it into my small car. Bring all those pieces over to my mom's garage because she lives 2 neighborhoods away. And I cut everything to spec there. And then I bring it back to my one bedroom apartment, much to the dismay of my girlfriend. And I paint everything here. I sand everything here, drill everything, put it all together, buy the components, and make a Miss Pac-Man that you would not be able to tell the difference of if you were in, if it was 1981 or 2017. And so what I found is that there is a huge market for people who are my age, who have disposable income, and who want to relive their old memories and spend, you know, $1,000 on a game like this. So that's what I do now. And so, yeah, that's where the arcade thing goes.
2 things. Number one, I really can't envision you, like, handling power tools. I just can't.
Okay.
I mean, is this something, like, have you always done handy things? Like, I know you've restored bikes and stuff before. Like, this level of, like, yeah, like, hardcore work, like, with with tools and with building and stuff. Did you do that like before? Did you used to make like skate ramps or anything like with tools?
What's funny is that not really. I outside of building like little launch ramps and skateboard things, like,
yeah,
not necessarily. I just like tinkering. I like tinkering and building things. I like taking things that used to be ugly and making them kind of pretty. So that's why I like picking up these arcade games that look like they've been in a fire and, you know, making them so somebody looks at it and says, wow, can I buy that off of you? Mm-hmm. So I like taking like really challenging projects and kind of working them over. But as far as power tools go, no. When I started, I was like, well, I need a circular saw. And I remember getting a circular saw for my birthday from my girlfriend. She's like, oh, I got you a circular saw. And I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. And so it was just like things like that. And I've amassed this, a tool set, I guess, not even a tool set, but just like a collection of different and very specific power tools over the years that I need. I'm like, man, this will cut my time in half if I get this tool and this tool. Mm-hmm. And it also helps that, one of my best friends in the world is, he works for the union, and union guy, he's always on jobs, and he's like, oh yeah, man, we got tons of extra tools. You need this tool? And he got me this tool, and I look it up, and I'm like, that's $250. I'm like, that's a super expensive tool. And this dude's just like, oh yeah, you can have that. So it makes my life a lot easier.
No, that's fair enough. I have been, I'm not allowed to use power tools because I once cut the top of my finger off with a bandsaw. So my father will not let me use a power tool now. I want to get a drill, but he won't. Have a drill, but I sliced through the top of my nail, I was bandsawing and not looking well enough because I used to use tools all the time. You know my father. You know like how much
of
like
course.
How what he does like in terms of his handiness. And I sliced through my nail through the nail, through the finger in a bandsaw. And that had to be that was a bad experience for me. So I'm a little nervous of power tools, but as long as you haven't cut anything off yet, more power to you.
Oh, I've definitely, I've always got like cuts all over my hands all the time. I'm always complaining about it.
And the second question was, because I don't know, like I am not a game person as we will speak about. But when you make these, you make them with the, like, decorations of a certain game? And I assume back in the day, like, back in the 80s, it was one game. Like, the computer played one type of game. Yours just replicate that? Or do you have, like, it just look like one, but you have the option to do a lot of games? Like, what is the computer? And Mitch would know way more about this than me. But, like, the computer system that gets put in.
Okay, well, I mean, this is where we're going to get into people who are very arcade purists. Now, arcade purists, I'm about to say certain words that are going to set them off, and there are trigger words for them for real. that will drive them up the wall. So when you say the word multicade to an arcade purist, they just, oh my God, I follow a group on Facebook that is just a meme group dedicated to making fun of people who make multicades like me. Sorry. All right?
So why do you follow it?
Because I love it. I mean, it's hilarious.
He loves drama.
It's not even drama. It's just like I love hearing about it. I love hearing the other things. So basically, what happens is in the early 80s, they used to make, like, if you went to a Ms. Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, a Frogger, or Space Invaders, they had this giant, what looked like a, microchip, okay? It's a big circuit board. It's called a PCB that was in the game, okay? It was a massive board because it was early 80s technology. Now it's 2017, okay? And you can do pretty much anything. What you hold in your back pocket has more power and can probably play the entire, collection of games that were out in 1981. So obviously that gives you a huge range to do, if you utilize technology. So what I do is I make multicade machines. And so what I do is I buy a PCB and it's a board, small. It's probably the size of like two iPhones. And it holds the ones that I use are the 60-in-1 games, which is the most traditional. They're the most popular, which means they are the vertically, what am I going to say? Can't think of the word right now. The vertical shooter games, essentially. So it's Ms. Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, Frogger, Burger Time, what have you. Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man. And so there's 60 of these games. on this board. Basically, you wire up everything with a JAMA harness, plug it in, and plug everything in, and everything should work the way that it did in 1981. And you play Ms. Pac-Man, and it looks exactly the way that it did in 1981. Now, if you're going to talk to purists, they're going to be like, well, you're using a, you know, a CRT monitor, which are those big, old, heavy, curved, you know, glass screens like see the or do you use a flat screen LCD? Now, flat screen LCDs are cheap. They're easy to replace. They're easy to install, but they're flat. Okay. So people are going to be like, well, that's not real. And that's not the same way. It's not going to look the same. And here's the thing. If you are not an arcade purist, you would not notice the difference. If you are a super arcade nerd and you know everything about every single little minute detail about an arcade game, you're going to instantly notice the difference. So when you go to arcades nowadays and you sit down and you go to play, you know, sit down Ms. Pac-Man or stand up Donkey Kong, most people would never notice the difference that there is a flat screen LCD monitor in there. But some do. So those purists, they hate that. It drives them up a wall because they say it's, you know, and the way that I liken it to is like this. I have a Ferrari. I'm going to sell you a Ferrari. It's the Ferrari that you love, that you loved ever since you were a kid. It looks just like a Ferrari. It drives just like a Ferrari. Just don't look under the hood. Because if you look under the hood, there's two lawnmower engines in there. But you never know the difference. You know what I'm saying? As long as it sounds the same. And it looks the same and it drives the same, you know, essentially it's a Ferrari. And for those people out there who are my age, who simply want to casually play a few games of Donkey Kong Jr. after a long week of work, they don't care that there's a couple lawnmower engines inside there. Do you know what I'm saying? But a Ferrari purist would be like, well, that is not the exact, you know, I don't know, camshaft, whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're going to be very picky and they're going to say, you can't put two lawnmower engines inside of a Ferrari and expect them to call it a Ferrari. So that's kind of, there's a huge disconnect in that world. And rightfully so, because some people just throw together a garbage game and what people refer to as Hellcades. And they look like garbage and they just throw a 60 in one of them and they try to sell them for like $1,000. So, what they say is it devalues what they're doing. And so there's huge infighting. And let me just put it to you like this. I didn't realize that there are communities and scenes for everything.
Oh,
for
of course everything. There are. But yeah, this I would have never thought of.
Exactly. It always boggles my mind. Like for me, I'm familiar with the punk and hardcore scenes. I know that there are, you know, scene climbers and backstabbers. I know that there are shit talkers and tourists. And so when I went and you started talking to Nat more about fandoms and, you know, Teen Wolf and all of these different things. Like, I find it fascinating. And she can tell you that when we're walking down the street, I'm always asking her questions about certain fandoms. I'm like, tell me about this. Tell me about this. Because it's a world that I don't know. Okay. It's a world that I have no idea about. And so when I learn
intrinsically always the same impulses of humanity within whatever subculture, you know, like there's always the same kind of like, yeah, hierarchies and people who just want to have fun and people who are like should have got out 7 years ago but just want to stay and complain about the changes and like that kind of thing. Like it crosses all boundaries.
It really always does. And each time it boggles my mind when I learn that there is a clown subculture fandom in Chicago, yeah. And there are cool people in the clown world. Like, oh, that's he's a legendary. He's a legend in the Chicago clown scene. I'm like, wait, what? That is a real conversation I had with someone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I tell you that there's our cool people, there's a cool person in the Chicago scene of arcade restoration, you'd be like, that's ridiculous.
Sure.
And
yes, okay.
I recognize that, but at the same time, it is a real thing. And somehow I've gotten myself involved in that community. And so there are people and in this community who are like, oh, you got to watch out for that guy. Oh, don't buy anything from him. Oh my God, he's a racist and he's this and he's that. Oh my God, it is a hot mess. So I don't even know how we got here, but I definitely.
Oh, games.
Yeah,
all I know is like, so when I stand up at your machine that says Donkey Kong on the sticker, I can play 60 games.
Yes, ma'am.
I can select a different game. Is that right?
Like 60 different games. Now,
Natalie, you're so precious.
Sorry.
People, other people do is they create MAME games, M-A-M-E. They have MAME games, which basically are you install a computer hard drive. Basically, you stick a computer inside of an old wooden box of, you know, an old arcade game, and you upload whatever, you know, certain software and certain emulators into it.
Yeah.
And then you can emulate any game, and you can have literally thousands of games. There's so many different platforms that people use nowadays, and especially with Raspberry Pi. I don't know if you're familiar with this new system, but there's Raspberry Pi and these tiny little computers that fit inside the box of an Altoid box, and you can run every single game that Nintendo has ever made for Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Sega, ColecoVision, Atari, Nintendo 64. Every single one of those old school games can fit on a Raspberry Pi that sits inside of an Altoid box. So that is also an option. You could literally take that, a Raspberry Pi, and stick it inside of. So the options are limitless at this point. So you can make anything. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I know very little about this. I'm sure Mitch knows a lot more. Mitch, before we go on to the actual hypes and gripes and the project, Mitch used to run a podcast called Radio 64. He used to have a Nintendo podcast. And
interesting.
And so, yeah, Mitch, is there anything, this is all your language, is there anything here that you are more interested in than or knowledgeable about that you wanted to ask about?
No, I think, Chris, you do a good job of talking highly of something you're really passionate about, and Natalie, you do a good job of asking questions about things that you don't seem to know too much about, but you still sound like you do, so that's good.
Agreed.
And I'm really intrigued, Chris, because one of my questions that I had specifically for you was, where do you like go about buying the parts for all these things? And I realized as you're talking, you don't just buy them, like you're creating half of this. I don't know, how are you creating these decals in like their original quality? You're not painting that by hand, are you? Like,
oh no, God, no. No, did I interrupt you?
No, you're fine.
Okay. Well, so long story short, you can just buy, basically you can buy those sets online now. There's certain people in this world who that is what they do. That is their hobby, that is their world. Where I create games, they make those decals, they make those stickers, they make those bezels, and marquees and side art. And so you can buy side art packages from people who only make, I only want to make Donkey Kong and Miss Pac-Man side art and packages, and that's what I want to do for a living. And that's what they do. And then people like, it's such a, you know, a niche market that, you know, once one person does it, there's a lot of people in this world who really want that decal, and they go to them and they can make a living off of it. And so there's certain things that I know how to do. Like I can build a cabinet from the ground up. I can make it look to the exact specs of a Galaga cabinet or a Donkey Kong cabinet. I can paint it, you know, match all the paints and T-molding and everything. But there are certain things that I just don't know how to do. Like I can't design, you know, exact specs to a, you know, Donkey Kong side art. So what I do is I just generally buy it from somebody else. But I have made like custom things for people. Like I'll go into Photoshop and move some images around and stuff. But I buy that from people. And there are like wholesale places online that sell certain components. Like you want to buy the buttons, like clearly I don't know how to mold buttons, but I can buy, you know, like certain buttons from certain places and certain joysticks that are up to spec with that machine and whatnot. So, that's basically, you can buy the wiring, you know, like the harnesses and all that kind of stuff and the power supplies and all that stuff. So, yeah, you can buy all that stuff, put it all together. Basically, the way I liken it to, and I was telling my girlfriend the other day, is that, you know what it's like? It's like having a model. It's like, you know, remember when you used to get, like, an old model plane or a model whatever? Maybe I'm dating myself right
like
now.
Like the Tonka, like, models, the wooden ones you put together.
Yeah, you just buy a model kit, and you look at this, and most people would look at that, and they'd be like, or I can just go out and buy the plane. Or I can just go out and buy the, you know, but you're like, but that's not the fun of it. The fun is putting the battleship together in all 5,000 pieces, you know, and that's kind of like what arcade games are to me. Basically, I love sanding them and painting them and making them look, you know, like new and fresh and taking this thing that was, you know, essentially rotting in a basement of an old bowling alley and paying $50 for it, coming home and cleaning out these spider eggs, you know, like,
oh no.
Literally have had, this is not a joke, literally have had to buy a bug bomb and fumigate games where I'd have to put the bomb in the middle of the game, set it off, leave for 4 hours to come back to find a pile of dead spiders. So, yeah. And then I like taking that, cleaning it all out, vacuuming it, wiping it all down, you know, sanitizing it, sanding it and stripping it and all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I've just always had a fascination and love of video games like anybody has, especially like kind of older stuff. You know, people like to gravitate towards the things that they, you know, grew up with. And so, but I never really got out of video games. So there was never like this golden era for me. Like, of course, I love like old school games, but you know, I had Sega, you know, just like everybody else did, and Nintendo 64 and PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2 and 3. And you know what I'm saying? So there was never like an era where I dropped off and stopped playing games.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious too. I don't know if this is too specific of a thing to ask. Do you go to one specific retailer? Or are you just buying off of like, I don't know, Etsy, eBay, Amazon? Or are you going to like kind of really basic mom and pop shop kind of people who are putting this together? And it's like you're saying, this is their life. So like what's their venue to sell this kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, there are a handful of people out there who are very specific and known for being credible people who sell quality products. And basically over the years, I've tried different places and figured out who is, you know, the most economical and who's the most trustworthy and who has the best customer service. And so, yeah, there are basically a handful of people out there who sell these things and that you know that you can get them and they'll be the work. Because there are places like you can go to like Alibaba and get stuff from China, and a lot of their stuff isn't compatible, doesn't work. you know, the English is broken on a lot of the games. So there's a lot of things that are, you know, come with bugs and flaws and imperfections, but there's a lot of, you know, mom and pop places kind of out there that deal in specific. I just want to sell Suzo Hap joysticks, you know, and that's where you go to them because you know that Mike's Arcade is a very reliable source to pick up stuff. So,
well, that's nice because I'm sure that you find that when all these good parts are coming together, you have this beautiful moment in anything technology when you have that aha, I did it, and it's kind of like I did it, but I don't know how I did it. I don't know if you've had that for like your first machine you put together.
That is perfect way to describe it. I'm not gonna lie, my first game I sold to my friend, this dude Jim, and all I knew was that it came JAMA wired. All right, so it means it was JAMA compatible. It means it had a certain harness that was compatible with the board that I would plug into it. Right. So all I know is I bought this game, hoped that all the mass and this like this massive box of wires. Literal wires just sticking out everywhere. Certain ones were cut in half and exposed wiring. And I could plug this board in and it would work. And it did. And I don't know how. I don't know what happened. I just remember it was my first game. And I said, is this JAMA compatible? And the guy was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, does it work? He's like, I don't know. He's like, you know. So I went and I brought it home and I plugged it in and it worked. And it shocked the hell out of me. And to be honest with you, I never changed anything. And now I feel bad. Like, I want to go and I want to be like, yeah, dude, let me just gut your machine. Let me redo it for you. Because it was a mass of wires. Like, for real. Like, they had installed and replaced so many different power supplies over the past 30 years.
And they're just leaving the extra junk in there just because.
Yes,
they're,
yeah, yes, they're like, exactly. Yeah,
not I'm worth glad dismantling that
you understand
your
my plight, Mitch. You know, I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where it's just this massive wires. And they were just like, well, we'll leave it there. Just screw in another one. And they screwed in another one. And they're like, oh, that one's broken. Instead of taking it out, let's put in another one. And there's just wires everywhere. So I have no idea how that thing still works. But he bought that thing 4 years ago and it still hasn't had a problem yet.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's funny. Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
One
I
day
love it so much.
His house will burn down.
Natalie.
All right. It's okay. It's all
no,
right.
No, no, that is a legitimate concern.
I know.
There's like a 15% chance that might actually happen.
Oh, just, God. Like, break in one day and redo it without telling him or something. Like,
I think about it often. I think about it often.
All right. So we're going to talk now about the structure of the show of our, what we do every week is we bring in basically a grievance to air and an obsession to share in terms of what we are passionate about this week, either in a positive or negative way. Chris is actually here today because he's in the middle of a campaign that combines his gaming with his obsession with cats. So we're going to talk about that a little bit as his hype, but just as an introduction for context. Yeah, Chris, I don't know if you want to do this or I can say sort of what I have taken from it from afar, which is that he in the last couple of, however many months or that you've been working on it behind the scenes, has got a charity registered in order for him to start a cat rescue, which will be a cat cafe, but it'll be an arcade. So it's going to be called the Catcade, and it's going to, instead of be like a little twee little library style cafe, it'll be an arcade style thing that is a cat cafe where you can pay to enter and play games and hang out with cats, and that there'll be rescue cats pulled from shelters, saved from being, executed at shelters, and that they will be rehomed and cared for at the cat cafe and can be adopted. So this is a pretty new and huge venture for Chris, who has always been a cat lady, and we have three cats here now as well, and Mitch has two in his life. So we're gonna talk about that pretty extensively, because it's a really new and interesting project that we hope that people might want to visit if they're in Chicago or support in the setup stage. So I think that we'll probably go through and do our gripes first, because so we can end on a more positive note. So sometimes we flip a coin, sometimes we have a really obvious starting point. I think that we'll do our complaints first and then our hypes second. So just in terms of gripes, mine is actually pretty simple in terms of arcades. I'll start with mine because it's kind of quick and simple. But it's just basically all of this is kind of like alien language to me, because I can't play video games. So I recently had a really big reminder of this hand-eye coordination problem that I have. I just can't do things in the right order from brain to hand, because we were at last weekend was my birthday, and we actually went to a wildlife park. I have taken Chris to several wildlife parks here in Australia before, and he is a big fan. But this was a different one, Chris, that you've never been to before, but it was quite a nice one. But anyway, we did a bird training experience. So we did an experience that was like $25, and you go behind the scenes in their bird area and get to see how they train some of the birds to have, behaviors and to do, a flight, then come back and stuff like that. And oh my God, I think I traumatized this bird, because they have a clicker training. So basically what happens is the bird will do a behavior, or it'll be asked to do a behavior. And if it's correct, it gets a reward. But because sometimes the reward doesn't come immediately, because, sometimes it'll be like in midair that, they've flown the right way or something. There's a training behavior, which is for all animals, which is you get it like a clicker sound. And that means they know they've done the right thing, that when they get back to you, they're going to get the treat, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So it's like they do the thing, they hear the click, and then they get the treat. I could not do this in the right order for the life of me. Like my brain, the bird would do the thing. I would do the hand signal. The bird would do the thing. I'd be clicking before it did it. Like I'd be like my impulse for my hands to do the activity, sort of the automated activity of the process. I cannot do it. And I hadn't my little brother used to play the drums. Cannot do that for the life of me. I took music classes and, for years in high school, and we used to, have a go on all the different instruments, different times. Cannot do that. And I just can't make my hands do things independently. I just can't do it. And I'm just, so that's kind of the main reason, as a kid, I was probably like, video games are stupid. No, I just can't do it. Like, I don't understand how people overcome this, or if it's like they start playing games before they start having that problem, so they never have that problem. I also don't drive, which is probably a big, a big thing of, like, that not being like a part of my brain that's very well attached. So I don't know, do you guys have this problem? Or obviously not, but is this something that is a thing in gaming?
I feel like it's kind of related to I have some friends that aren't capable of playing volleyball correctly. And I find volleyball in video games always seem to relate in terms of if you're able to, because that's a very specific hand-eye coordination as well, along with music. But it's funny, because now that I'm thinking in gym class of my friends that are in high school who could not put their hands together to hit the ball up in the right time, they're also really bad at video games when I play with them. Mm-hmm. So I do think a lot of it does come from being a child. I remember being 5 years old and beating Super Mario World, the first one ever on Game Boy. And it was very exciting, and I was doing it. And I actually, honestly, there's some points when I think that I either had the persistence or just something else that made me an even better video game player as a kid. Like, I was doing crazy things in games. I don't know what it was. Because now I play the same Super Mario game, and I'm not as good at it. I don't have the same patience. I die, I quit. But then as a kid, you really can... I don't think you know how horrible life can be when you lose when you're a kid. So you have this certain persistence that teaches you that if you keep doing it, you're going to gain this hand-eye coordination. And that's where I can kind of relate from it, Natalie, because I understand where you're coming from and saying, like, maybe driving would get you there. But I do think it is generally something that it's like a language. It's like you're taught it as a kid, you're going to know it very fluently. If you're taught
exactly.
It'll be like a bit of a stumble.
Mm. Oh, I couldn't agree with that more.
Do you think that I'm missing out on, like I'm not that stupid. I'm not stupid.
It's not
stupid. Do you think I'm missing out?
No.
Do you think I'm missing out on, like, a some sort of, like, function? Like, I don't know.
Natalie, you know how you tell me not to watch Supernatural for my own good?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you not to play video games for your own good. Because something I find that's common in you in personalities like yourself and I is that we become very immersed and very addicted into communities and into places where you're discussing and you're alike and you're doing that thing. I stay away from, like, for instance, MMOs. Those are the kind of games I could see you getting into. That's massively multiplayer online. That's where you're literally just going online and playing with other people and chatting and doing fun things. It doesn't have to be intense, but a lot of it's like the socialization of it all. I refuse to play them because I know I would never get off of them. Those are the kind of games I think you would love, but do not do them. They're not so hand-eye coordination all the time. I mean, they can be, but I would just say no. Don't try those. If anything, just try starting off with some basics. Mario is always a good one to start off with. Arcade games are very hard. Chris is probably a lot better at... I mean, Donkey Kong Jr. still makes me angry. Pac-Man is a very intense, like the ghosts are chasing after you. Don't start with those, Natalie. Start with something maybe a bit lighter. So maybe if you really want to, but...
I will tell you all of the things that I have played, and they've all been computer-based, like PC-based. I have played Tetris by using the mouse, not by using the keys,
I think. That's fine.
I have played the practice room on Tomb Raider of just making her jump around the house.
Yeah, that's pretty tough.
Because that's all I enjoyed. And I have played Commander Keen. We used to have that. Again, this is PC-based, and I have played the maze in Encarta. Chris, Mitch, is Encarta before your time? Encarta was like it's like Wikipedia, except it was like a CD-ROM, like CD-ROM encyclopedia program. And it had basically a game that came with it where it's like you used your knowledge from Encarta to go through a castle. Those are all of the computer games that I have played, and they were all PC-based and all based in pointing the mouse, not by thumb and up and down keys and stuff like that. So there's definitely some sort of problem, but
well, this is very American. Did you play Oregon Trail?
Right.
No, yes! In like, primary school. Like, I mean, like when I was, like, 5 or 6, yes. Yes, when we used to have the old computers that were the black light, you know, like the I remember in school we still had the computers that were the black screen, green type or orange type on PCs just before, like, full-color monitors came in. And so, yes, in primary school, very, very young, we would have had a few goes of that.
That was probably one of the first games I started. And see, Natalie, the one thing that I think, as you're saying, was story-based that you would have appreciated maybe even more as a kid about video games is that I learned a lot of vocabulary from games because often it's just like you're out in the real world in your mind when you're a kid. You're out in the real world in this game and you're playing Pokemon and you're like buying things and you have to like say sell or buy or... whatever it is, and like you have to give quantities. Like, it teaches really basic concepts to play a role-playing game like that too, so I'm only sad that you hadn't experienced that, because I do think that that's something pretty unique to growing up as millennials, to have that, like, we learned how to live through video games in a weird way. Like, it's kind of fun when you think back to it too. But Chris, what's your interaction with when you started playing games? Were you playing arcade games when you were younger? Is that how you got into it?
Well, what's funny is that I like to think that I'm not very out of touch as a dude who's my age, right? Like, you know, I never really kind of like lost touch with everything. And in that way, like, I can see the disconnect between that era that I grew up in and the era of, you know, the MMOs and you know, things like Warcraft and all that kind of stuff. I can see all the connections between all of these things. Now, the difference is that in the early 80s, which is referred to as the golden era of games, the goal was to make more money. So back then it wasn't, yeah, they had Atari, but everybody, what people don't understand is that number one, arcades were, it was a social thing. It wasn't just like I play arcade games. If you look at things like, go watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, that old 80s movie, they're all hanging out the arcade. That's what you did when you were a kid. If you were a bad kid, that's where you went to sell, you know, pot, you know, like you bought weed there. Like kids, you know, had like knives and smoked. That was when you could still smoke in arcade games. So that was where like the seedy, sketchy kids went. And that's where the cool kids went. And that's where you wanted to go when you were going to get into trouble. It was a thing. It wasn't just like, I'm going to go play Pac-Man. It was, I'm going to the arcade and that's where I'm spending all day there. Now, the goal back then was to make money, okay? And so what they wanted to do was, you played a game for a quarter, and how do we get you to keep pumping quarters into this machine? So those games, when Mitch said, hey, don't start out with something, you know, like Donkey Kong, because it's going to be frustrating, he's right. It was intentionally made to be difficult. I think in that documentary, King of Kong, they said the average Donkey Kong game lasts 90 seconds. That's the average length. Because the idea was, you were pissed, so you wanted to put another quarter in. And so, once there was the crash of the arcade industry in the mid-80s and everything started going to home consoles when, you know, like the original Nintendo came out, the NES, what happened was that there was a shift. And they knew that if you were going to die and your game was going to end and it was at home, you were going to give up playing that thing. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to make it easier for you. They also wanted to give you save points, which were a huge turning point in the video game industry. So once they started giving you save points, you felt like you didn't give up. So when there's games, when you play games like Pac-Man and you die three times, you just start right back over again. And so in the commerce area of it in the early 80s to make money, I understand why they did that. They did it because they wanted you to keep popping quarters in there. But once it got home, they wanted you to sit there and play this game so you would invest $60 more into the next game that they came out with. I can't remember what your original question was.
there's no real question, just a concept. Yeah, basically that... I don't know. Yeah. Like whether a part of my brain is undeveloped from not having this skill or something. I don't know. Like,
aren't you musical though? You said you couldn't play drums, but I do think that
I can't, I'm not that good at any instruments. I played clarinet for a little while.
You and did
that,
too?
That's, it's very, yeah, yeah. It's a different kind of thing. I used to like watching my brother play Mortal Kombat. Don't tell Karen. And, because I liked the characters, like I was like, what's the history of that? Like the little blurb about like where all the different characters were from, like that. I was interested. I'm always interested in story based stuff, but, I don't know. We have a friend, who's on this show, Chris, who's like her greatest, it's not even a guilty pleasure cause she's not ashamed of it. Is her but she's unbelievably in love with the Mortal Kombat movie from the early 90s or the mid 90s, whatever that was.
Oh no, why?
We often ask her and she just responds with, you need to watch it. And
I was in the theater the day that thing came out, and I can tell you, literally the day that it came out, because Boo worked at the theater, at the Clock Tower Theater in Downers Grove, Illinois, and he used to get us into premieres all the time, and he got us into Mortal Kombat, and we walked out of there, and we loved Mortal Kombat. You don't understand. We were obsessed with Mortal Kombat, and we walked out of that thing going like, that was a steaming pile of shit. So yeah. That's my question is, why? I'm curious.
We don't know.
I'm not judging her for her taste. I have plenty of things that are very questionable. I'm not going to lie. But at the same time, I just want to hear why. I need to know what
she also genuinely loves the Tremors series, which I did not know what it was until she introduced it to me. She likes some really odd things, and she's very demure, like very cutesy girl as well. And I have no idea, like,
listen, Tremors.
Anyway, pardon?
Tremors was an amazing movie. I love that thing.
Is it? Oh, anyway. that's fine. Sorry, Karen. Anyway, moving on from that. Mitch, yours was talking about we've talked a bit about the obviously the scenes that we've experienced that you know Chris has experienced in making his arcades, but what was your gripe specifically about this week in terms of this situation?
Well, I hate to feel so specific toward just Chris and not be able to relate so much to video games with Natalie.
It's fine.
But it's unfortunate that often human beings, this is not just video games, but as you guys were just talking about with fandoms, people get nasty, and I particularly do not appreciate the horrible nastiness that comes with anonymity of people online. That will be angry towards you because you won. It's there's like a certain level I think that's okay. That's kind of like tongue in cheek. Like it's kind of funny to teabag someone, Natalie. It's when you when you continuously crouch over someone after you've killed them to be like, ha, here's my junk in your face. And that's kind of like
I understand the concept in real life. I was not aware this is a
in real life.
Oh, it is.
So I mean, there's if it's kind of funny and tongue in cheek, but when it comes to the, I mean. I personally do not play games with voice chats because I can't stand the way that people get all... I mean, it's really just people swearing 24/7 at each other. There's no positive environment to that.
It's mostly racist. If you want to see somebody's racism really come out, give them a mic.
Yes, it's horrible because they're all anonymous. So they just go crazy. Mm-hmm. And personally, I play Smash Bros. A lot, as Natalie, I'm sure you know by now. And that's, yes, the game that has the longest... piece of literature written about it, the fan fiction, unfortunately, that we're talking about way back when.
Like, randomly, Chris, did you happen to know that in the world of fan fiction, which you conceptually understand, the longest fan fiction ever written is like a Super Smash Brothers, like ongoing, like multi-chapter fan fiction? I've never seen it, but allegedly this is true, like... I don't know. Is Super Smash Brothers like all of the best characters from the different Nintendo worlds? Is that what it is?
It is. And I personally have a strong affinity for Princess Zelda, which people like to laugh at online because when I'm playing against them, they're like, I was beat by a girl, chortle, because that's kind of still a thing, unfortunately. So, it gets uncomfortable because I unfortunately made personal accounts. Like, you know, you can make a me on the Wii. And that's how people can see you, like, you know, what character you are. And I put my actual name on there. And it gets uncomfortable because sometimes if you actually, like, are doing well and you're playing as a certain character, people will come after me. And just, I mean, they're going to call you horrible names no matter what. And the worst of it all is usually when people are in matches with you. And it's not fun at certain points because they're just calling you names via the little text boxes that they can pop up. And they're just going to report you so that you can't play in the main server. You're going to play in, like... the nega server where only the people who really deserve to be there are, and then you. I've been there before because people didn't like me as a player for winning, like legitimately. And this is that's where I'm saying like it becomes toxic, not past like the teabagging is fine. I get that. But when we get to like reporting each other for being good at a game, for playing it like it should be, or for not liking a character, or for not liking a person, whatever it is, being racist, I mean, that happens all the time. It's just. It blows my mind, and it's so uncomfortable at times that I'm like, I just can't touch this console for the next ever, because people on here are so disgusting. They just, and this is not exclusive to just Smash Bros. I know every single game out there will have this.
Oh my god, this is so
crazy. Natalie, I mean, this is a...
And Mitch, you are a homosexual.
Yeah.
How's that?
Well, there... to what point I can or can't say this, I never really know, but the word fag is often used online in any forum of people being angry. So that happened, or like Uncivilized, I suppose. And that comes out a lot, unfortunately, when you're playing against little kids on games. And that's a name that I often get called. And you kind of reach a threshold where you stop caring. You don't take it specifically to yourself because, A, they don't really know you in real life, so it's not really aimed at you. And, B, it's just they're blowing off hot steam because they're worse at the game than you. So the way I kind of look at it from there is I'm just like, okay, so you hate me because I'm good. I think that I'm the winner here. But yeah, it's it can be really taxing to sit through, and it takes away the enjoyment, unfortunately, when it's just, you know, everyone looking to make it a negative experience for you. And they'll find a way, Natalie. Like, you'd be surprised by how shitty humanity can be when it wants to, because you wouldn't think you would be, but still, there are little tiny ways, and even games without text chat, with just the way people would react to you, that's just very specific, and you know it's aimed at you, and it's because they're bullying you, but non-verbally, and they never would have contact with you. It's just this little character doing it to you. Oh, I know. It's
what? What is the benefit of playing against other players who are online versus playing against the computer?
The computer will not do anything like a human would. You can't. I mean, that's pretty much the whole point of all of these like Terminator AI movies, right? Like, we don't want humans and computers to have the same mind. So it's just not as entertaining, essentially, because you can predict the computers no matter what game you're playing. You could, even if they're, you know, able to read your button layouts, it's still like the human mind is going to be still quicker and more intuitive, and it's going to read the situation differently. So I think that's why I personally play games online, and I do so sparingly. Smash Bros. Is my crack, unfortunately. It's been like that since... Natalie, here's the hard part. I started playing this game when I was around 7. I have not stopped. Okay? So, take it or leave it. That's just video game culture. It's humans, really. But I know that personally I find it to be pretty disturbing and upsetting on Smash Bros. For Wii U. So I played the 3DS one, where people can't call you text names. But like I said, Natalie, they still bully you when they want to. But I just go through with a thick skin and I'm like, all right, I'm still better than you. I know I'm not going to reach down to this level of like elementary school, I don't know, bullying, teasing. In a way, it's just, it's so weird. It's so hard to describe it to someone, Natalie, that you, like, you're not into this. So you don't know, like, firsthand how it is, but you don't want to.
Yeah, I don't. I don't watch a lot of people gaming. Chris is one of the only people I've ever, like, seen play a video game in front of me. I don't go to a lot of people's houses who have games. Another one of my male friends, Jonathan, in the UK, he also does. But, yeah, Chris plays a lot of, or used to play a lot of, like, the first-person shooters with the headset situation going on. So I don't know what happens there. It's all very violent.
I play Call of Duty basically since its inception. And since it's been online, and I'm still obsessed with it, still play it every day. And so when you're talking about how it brings out the worst of humanity, it really does. But to be honest with you, I'm the dude who calls it out. Like, I love calling it out, because I mean, I'm not going to let some, like, you know, maybe some 16-year-old's never been called out, you know, maybe some grown ass man has never been called out, and I'll call people out on like the headsets. And if they just keep persisting, which they usually do, like, I always report them. Like, I'm that dude. I'm that narc.
What kind of things would you say to them? Like, they would say they would say what, and then you would say what?
I mean, you know how it is. It's like always homophobic or racist stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you dare be a gay female person of color on an...
Dude, seriously. Like, if you're... Yeah, exactly. And especially if you're a woman and you're gaming and it's either dudes either hitting on you the whole time, or it's dudes saying, like, the worst shit in the entire world.
Can they see you on video?
No, not typically. Audio? I hope not.
Yeah, no. No, they could just see, you know, what you have in your gamer profile and your gamer tag.
Okay.
But, you know, you can easily put in, you know, what your name is and, you know.
Yeah.
And so you'll see, like, the worst of humanity come out. And so I generally like to fuck with people, and I like to call people out. It depends on the circumstance, depends on how they're handling it, how what they're saying, and how aggressive they're being. But I always call things out, because the way that I see it is, like, they use their power of being anonymous, like we spoke about before, you know. Like, they can say whatever they want because they're anonymous. I don't know who they are, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know where they live. I don't know, you know, I don't know any of that stuff. So why not use that against them as well. Be like, hey, man, you know, like, why are you saying this shit? Like, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, like, hey, you know, like, when you call people out like that, they can't find you either. You know, so why not take that opportunity to call people out, to scold people for their behavior, or even just engage them? Be like, dude, come on, man. Why would you say shit like that? You know, like, come on, man. Like, why would you, you know, start calling people like these really racist things? Like, why would you say that shit? You know, and when you put them on the spot and you call them out, instead of being like, well, fuck you too. Instead of actually engaging them on a, like, dude, come on, man. What's wrong with you? Kind of, you know, it shames them as well. Yeah. You know, and it shames them into, you know, kind of like reevaluating what the hell they're saying. Yeah. And a lot of times when I do that, people will leave the room.
Yeah.
So
Leo's favorite thing to do, not in gaming, but in life, Leo's favorite thing to do is when people make like a joke that they kind of is either a bit racist or homophobic, and they kind of expect people to go, she'll really innocently go, I don't get it. Like, as in, like, can, like, kind of, like, make the person explain, like, why it's funny, and then, like, you know
that.
What I mean? Like, make the person break down, like, what the, and then, oh, but why is that funny? Like, kind of, like, you know, like, she knows what she's doing, obviously. Like,
oh, my God.
It's manipulation, but, yeah, to make
brilliant.
People break down, like, oh, like, basically, can you explain this joke to me and make them break down that it's racist and then be like, oh.
I think that's a brilliant tactic. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, that is pretty smart.
But, yeah.
I mean, Natalie, if you want, I suppose, an unfortunate taste of what this is, I remember I just found this old article that Medium put out, and it was of a woman describing her, the title of the article is... My first virtual reality groping, and
what?
I'm not making this shit up. Like, this is what it's like to be anything on the internet. There is no safe space in the video game world. You will. She was wearing a VR helmet, and I think men were being disgusting to her in the digital landscape, like walking around and like moving their hands and inappropriate gestures and all these kind of. So, it's not uncommon, even in games like Smash Bros, like a Nintendo and like a kid-based kind of thing, you know, to find just like swastikas and KKK stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's just...
Oh, yeah.
And it's too big, and it's too... You can't control that, because the way people will find a way, once again, to find their hate, to find a way to get through, is always amazing to me, because I'm like, how did you, like, come up with this weird character to, like I'm saying, like, text character, to actually display the letters KKK, but in, like, a different format? And, like, they just... You know what I mean? It's just something they would always bypass the computer system, but so a human mind would understand it. And there's some disgusting shit out there, and it's come to the point where I've even had to take, like, months breaks where I was just like, I can't deal with this. This is too negative. It's not as fun as it used to be because people are still finding ways, you know. But I think I found my own zen by, like, what you guys are saying, just kind of, like, I don't feed the trolls, and when they do want to be fed... I like what Leo does there a lot, Natalie. I'm still kind of laughing about that because that's pretty amazing. So I'm going to take that advice, and if I ever do have the opportunity, which I try and avoid, but if I have the opportunity to talk to people online while I'm playing with them, you know, on games, I'll try and be like, I don't get the joke. Can you explain it to me? And I'll just let them just sit on it and then have to explain the horribleness. So thanks for hearing out my niche, but maybe not so niche daily experience of life. That I, you're saying Call of Duty, Chris. I know that's even worse.
It really is. I mean, you know, because it brings out all the aggro, you know, really aggressive bro type gamers. Mm-hmm. So, it's hyper masculine, and you just it was. Let me put it to you like this: you know, my friend Dave Cronin. He's very, you know, questionable, but progressive dude. So when, not that I necessarily agree with these tactics, but when people would say like really homophobic or racist shit on there, he would get on there and he would say some really inappropriate things to him. He'd be like, yeah, so what? I like to suck cock. So what? And they'd be like, oh my God, you're gay. And he's like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to find you. He's like, I know your IP address. I'm going to find
God.
You. He's like, and then I'm going to molest you. And he would say all this insane stuff. He would say, I'm going to make you have to get a therapist. And like, he would say,
oh my God.
But I mean, listen, again, not something that I would do, but at the same time, it was kind of like giving
it's a tactic.
Is it effective? Who knows? But at the same time, it's kind of like taking that power back from these, you know, super misogynistic, racist creeps and making them feel a little bit of what they put out into the world. And so he would say all this stuff. He's like, I'm going to find you and suck your cock. And they'd be like, oh my God.
I don't know. If because you fight fire with fire, you're only gonna get burned, honestly. Exactly. Listen, beating a troll, because then it's to the point where it's just like, who's the bigger man here? No one.
No, I completely agree with that. And it's, again, not a tactic I would use. But at the same time, it's kind of giving them a little bit of the taste of the creepiness that they put out in the world. And then hopefully that they would be like, oh, my God, maybe I'm making other people feel like this. This is how it feels. Oh, my God, I've never been bullied in this way. Oh my God. So yeah, is it reverse bullying? Of course it is. But at the same time, it's really fucked up, all the things. But he would be like, dude, give me the microphone. Give me the microphone. I mean, yeah. Anyways, the catcade.
Anyway, yeah, so moving on much more away from gaming now into the actual specifics of your campaign, which, yeah, Chris, if you want to talk about changing tack a bit, your gripe, if you wanted to talk about the vegan thing, the money thing, I think I can transition in very well in a minute. So if you want to talk about the changing tack a bit to your new career as an animal activist, I guess.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say animal activist, but long story short, my girlfriend and I are crazy cat people, right? So we've traveled, and you know how much I like to travel. Every time we go somewhere, we always go and we try to see if there's a cat cafe in that city. So last year we were in Peru and went to the cat park. We went to multiple ones in Tokyo and in Amsterdam. And when I was in Sydney, and we just went to one in Tijuana, Mexico. And so we're those people who, you know, in Tijuana, Tijuana, Amsterdam are known for, you know, finding drugs and hookers. But instead, we went to the cat cafe.
Where's the good cats?
Yes, no, but for real, that's what we did. And we went there like multiple times. And so that's where we find our enjoyment, because we're, you know, these crazy cat people. And long story short, we were at one in San Diego. And
I know that one. Gas Lab?
I know. There was like a 45-minute wait to get in, right? So we finally get in, and there was a board, and it says, you know, as of, you know, this date, you know, this year, we've saved 248 cats or something. I can't remember what it said. And so I was like, wow, that's really awesome. Like, that was the time when it really hit me, where I was like, oh my God, I forget that, you know, yeah, this is a touristy thing. Yeah, it's like kind of a novelty thing where you go, you get your latte and you go in and you get to hang out and touch cats, right? And that's awesome. I love it. But at the same time, ideally, what the thing is that it's the novelty of, you know, of having a cat cafe to get you in to hopefully find a forever home for, you know, these cats that would, you know, under normal circumstances be euthanized because they couldn't be adopted out. Now, 72% of all animals that enter animal shelters end up euthanized. All right. That was a 2016 statistic from the ASPCA. And so basically, if you lose your cat, if you lose your dog and you don't come to get it within 14 days, they kill it. Okay. So basically what they do is they put it out on the website, and if nobody shows up for 2 weeks, it could be a feral cat. It could be a house cat. It could be a young cat. It doesn't matter if it's not getting adopted out. They have so many animals coming in and out that they need to make room. And so what they do is they kill them. And so it was kind of a bum out. Now, the thing is that we basically saw this, and, you know, my girlfriend actually came up with the idea of starting a, you know, like a cat rescue. And I was like, oh, it's brilliant. And then I was like thinking, I was like, wait a minute, here's the thing. Like, I don't want to be serving lattes. I don't. All right. I just have no desire to. So I was like, so how do we do this without having to get a food and beverage license? Because that's a whole other world too. You know, because the thing is that there's so many laws and restrictions and regulations on cat cafes in America, and you don't realize how many there are. And there's a reason why America is so behind on cat cafes, and it's because the FDA finally approved the use of cat cafes in America within the past few years. And so there's been getting so much pushback from so many different cities, like locally. state and city regulations. And so Chicago just approved cat cafes as of a year ago. And so what you have to do is, if you have a cat cafe, you're serving a beverage. And if you're serving a beverage, that means you have to have a food and beverage license. If you have a food and beverage license, that means you have to have a separation between you and the cats, not just like a wall, but like a separate facility. Okay. It has to have separate air intake and separate ventilation. So it can't have the same radiator, can't have the same heater, can't have the same air conditioning. You have to have two of everything. Essentially, you're buying two separate spaces. They just happen to be right next to each other. And so we didn't want to have to go through all of that. So what I said was, I was like, well, what about if we take this love that I have of making arcade games and combine it with that? And I said, what about a Catcade? So after much Googling, I'm pretty sure, I'm going to go out there and say it, like, I think we are the first concept, or first people to have this concept, which makes it unbelievably difficult when you go into the small business office in the city of Chicago and you propose them your idea and they're like, wait, what? A what? Wait, a cat, what's a cat cafe? Wait, a Catcade? And you just watch these people's minds like blow smoke. It's crazy. But so what we want to do is, essentially, we wanted to make a difference in our corner of the world. And this kind of like likens to what I do and what I have been doing for the past 10 years with my writing and my touring, which we didn't really touch on too much. But I just want to give a quick overview to show how the transition worked. Long story short, I'm going to get a little serious here. when I started writing these stories that seemed to resonate with certain people. And from what some people might think, that I had a bit of an interesting or tragic upbringing. And so what I found was, like any therapist will tell you, if you write about your, you know, if you write about your tragedy, if you write about your insecurities and your damages, it actually helps. It helps you make sense. It helps calm things down in your head and your heart. And so what I did with starting with my first book, On the Upswing, was I started writing about those tragic things that I endured, survived, or was a victim of growing up. And it helped me. It was my therapy. And Nat, you've seen me dozens of times do speakings, and you'll know that one of the things that I always say is that, like, you think that I'm up here for entertainment, but really what I'm up here is, this is my therapy session. And each time, out of the hundreds, I've done over 500 speakings now, and out of the hundreds of speakings that I've given, each one of those was a little therapy session for me to talk about the insecurities that I've had, that I have, the shortcomings, the regrets. All of these things help when you speak about them constantly, or when you write about them constantly. And instead of, what I always liken it to is, instead of letting all of your insecurities guide you through life, you get to grab that leash and you get to guide them. And so when I talk about, you know, the abuse that I suffered when I was young, the death that I, you know, had to, you know, view sometimes, whether it was, you know, like my little brother or my grandfather getting killed behind my house, or seeing drive-by shootings happen in front of me, or running from the police, or harboring fugitives in my basement, or, you know, my uncle who stomped a man to death, or, you know, my other uncle who died of AIDS, or any number of these things that didn't make sense to a little kid, you know, as an adult, you have to live with that shit. You have to deal with it. You have to absorb it, and you have to learn to live with it and not avoid it. And so that's what I did through my writing. And that tend to resonate with my audience. And so when I would go places and when I would do my speakings, it would be like half funny, but half also serious. And what I did, what I noticed, what the great thing about this was, that people would come up to me and they would tell me all these amazing things about how what I was doing was important to them. Okay. Regardless of how I see myself, because I'm a fairly self-deprecating kind of guy, but it made a difference in other people. And I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting it to the extent that that I was hearing it, that people were hugging me and crying and sending me letters. And I couldn't believe that I had that ability in me to make a difference. Okay. And so for me, it was this, another one of those turning point moments where I was like, oh my God, if I can help people, if I can help things, if I can make somebody's life easier by allowing them to find commonality in my words, or helping filter some of their damage through me, whether it's through an email or through a phone call, or, you know, them sitting me down over coffee and telling me all their, you know, deep secrets. Like, it's a great feeling to know that you're useful. And whenever I'm do these speakings, whenever I go to, you know, I just did a couple of months ago, I did a speaking at a high school, which is really tough because I couldn't swear. But I had to speak to a room of 300 kids who don't know who the hell I am. They don't give a shit about who I was friends with. They don't give a shit about, you know, what band sang a song about me. They don't care. They just see some, you know, kind of like aging punk rock dude standing on a stage, and they're like, oh, we got to be here for another hour and listen to this loudmouth talk at us. So how do I get through to them? And I love that challenge. I love that challenge of feeling like I have to be entertaining, but I also have to be useful. And how do I do that? And so I love that challenge. And I love knowing that people come up to me afterward, and how I get people to follow me on Instagram, or I get them to follow my Facebook, or read my words, or buy my books. That support makes me feel useful. It makes me feel like I have a purpose here. And so I wanted to transition into something a little bit even more local, and something that I feel like combines all of these passions that I have of video games and cats. Because, like, how fucking cool is that to be able to wake up and go into what would be technically considered work and be able to hang out with a bunch of cats and to be able to play video games, and knowing that I'm taking these death row cats, essentially. We would be going to the Chicago Animal Care Control, and we would ask for their death row cats, meaning the ones that are about to get euthanized any day. And we would take them and bring them to our facility, and where they would stay, and they would not get euthanized, and they would stay until they find their forever home. So that is the purpose of what we're doing with the Catcade. Again, it's a what we think is a pretty unique concept of combining arcade games and video game theme with saving cats. So, yeah, that's what I'm currently fundraising. That's what we're currently working on and working toward. And, yeah, I hope that answers your question.
I'm really curious. There's a lot of logistical stuff that I'm sure that's on your mind too, Natalie. What are you thinking about with all this?
Well, no. I mean, there's a ton of stuff, and Chris has been posting about it recently.
Okay, yeah.
But in terms of the like the issues that this has raised for you, I was curious about the one that you spoke about, or that you wrote down about the what you said about veganism. Is that something that you have experienced from other people, or is that kind of something that you're beating yourself up about, like in terms of that problem?
It's the latter. Absolutely. No one has actually said anything about it, but I've been beating myself up about it because I can understand that there's a bit of a hypocrisy there. Yes, I do eat meat on occasion. I feel like I'm trying to, you know, like make excuses for myself and say, well, I don't eat meat that often, but I don't. But I do understand that. And I think that because I've grown up around so many vegans, because veganism was such a prevalent thing, especially in the hardcore community in the 90s, when it wasn't as prevalent as it is now, you know, I know that that is an issue. I know that there are people out there who are going to say, oh, well, you want to help save lives, stop eating meat. And I understand that. And that totally makes sense. But at the same time, it's like I have these conversations in my brain, like everybody does before they go to sleep, you know, and they're like, you replay things in your head and you're like, how do I counter this? How do I say this? And I always, you know, like to say, like, well, I mean, do you ask your vet, you know, if they've eaten a hamburger lately? Do you ask, like, the animal care and control workers? Do you ask any of the other any of the cat cafe people? Do you ask them if they're vegetarians or vegans? And so, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's a petty thing for someone to say, like, well, you're not vegan, you're not vegetarian. Because at the end of the day, like, I am trying to make a little bit of a difference. Yes, I know all life should be the same, and I know whether it's a chicken or a cat, I get it. But cats are something that I have always had an affinity for. It's something that that's always been therapeutic for me. And I've always had cats my whole life, outside of, like, one apartment where we couldn't have cats. But I've always had them. That has been something that has been you know, kind of, I've been beating myself up over, like, but literally not one person has mentioned it to me, but I do know that it's something that's probably in the back of the mind of a handful of my friends who are vegan and vegetarian. So.
Yeah. I think there is a bit of a disconnect between like pet rescue and like animal rights activism, if you know what I mean. Like, I think there's a bit of a disconnect there. I get why that would be something that you'd start asking yourself questions about. I'm a vegetarian. I have been since I was very young, but it's sort of a different story. But yeah, I never thought of it. Like, when you wrote that down, I was like, has someone like said something about that? Because I didn't even think of it, to be honest. And cats are not vegan as well.
Well, I mean, like, I mean, that's a
requires, you know, meat.
Yeah, that's not the biggest issue that I have. The biggest issue that I have in the entire thing. But talking about the logistical things, Mitch, sorry. Mm. What were the questions that you might have had about the logistics of it?
Okay, so I something that I wake up to that's kind of unpleasant is that sometimes cats have hairballs and sometimes that makes a mess. I imagine that's a bit of a logistical issue for a cat cafe and a cat kid. So I know, how do you deal with like the general hairiness, messiness of a cat? Like, that means you're like janitorial staff on top of being like arcade. Like, that's, and also, I mean, the cat has to go to the bathroom somewhere. So you must have a special room that you set up. I mean, this, and accidents will happen. So all of this, it's the first thing that comes to my mind as a cat owner, because my cats are, you know, they're very good and kind to me, and they don't intentionally make messes, but it happens. And what's your plan to combat that? Are you going to like hire someone specifically to maintain the space, or are you going to wear all these different hats to try and maintain that as well?
Well, we are a nonprofit charitable organization, meaning that we got our 501c3 approval through the IRS. What that means is that we are a registered charity. Okay. So that means that we can actually have volunteers come in and work for us. I don't know if you've ever tried to volunteer somewhere, but the one great thing about the world, if you ever feel bad about humanity, try and volunteer somewhere, because it's pretty damn difficult, because there's so many people who want to volunteer. I have a lot of extra time, and so I've tried to volunteer at the there's a children's hospital that used to be down the street from me, and I called them and I was like, hi, I would like to volunteer. And they said, oh, there's a 6-month waiting list. You also have to fill out this 25-page form online. And I'm like, oh my God, I tried to volunteer at a soup kitchen, you know, feeding the homeless. And they're like, okay. They're like, well, there's a 2-month wait on that right now. And you have to bring a minimum of 15 people and bring $250 worth of food. So it's, I mean, outside of like the little logistics of bringing food, but there are so many people in this world who want to donate time. And so that's what's great about being a charitable nonprofit, is that we have the ability to have these people and, you know, legally have volunteers help us with all of this. So and I've already gotten at least a dozen people who have contacted me who said they want to volunteer. That's without even posting anywhere about that we're looking for volunteers. So we will need a staff of a handful of people to help us with our day-to-day operations, as well as running the front desk. But as far as building the litter and the cleanup and all that kind of stuff, so there will be people doing that. There will be regular feedings. I am, like I said, like I'm about a 6 on a handy scale. So I'm going to be building an enclosure for the litter boxes, actually a concept that we stole from the cat cafe in Tijuana, which they built a box, like a giant box. It was like 6 feet by 4 feet. You know, it's huge. And basically put these swinging doors on it, you know, kind of like in outdoors. And so the cats could go in and out, and it would still kind of keep all of the mess and the scent in there. And then there was a little side door on a hinge. You open it up, you pull out the litter boxes, and you can clean them. And then it also gives them a giant box to climb on. And so, we have put a lot of thought, effort, and planning into everything that's going on. I mean, it's been over a year of us planning this, and I didn't want to announce that I was working on this until we got our 501c3 approval, because most people don't get it. Most people don't. You're a tax exempt organization, and that's the last thing the government really wants, is to not get money from you. Right. And so once they go over your business plan and they look into everything and they see what you're doing, then they grant you this 501c3 approval. And what that does is it makes you eligible for state and federal grants, and it also gives a legitimacy to your charity. It's also being looked at and scrutinized by the IRS, who want weekly meeting notes. I mean, they want so much stuff from you that there's no way that I could ever possibly, like, I own a Lamborghini and a mountain of cocaine off of this cat cake. You know, like, you can't get away with something like that. And they ensure that. And that's what that 501c3 status does, is it gives you that validity and that credibility of the IRS saying, hey, we've looked into these people and they're on the up and up. Don't worry.
Oh, wow.
Your donation. Your donation is also tax exempt, or I mean tax deductible. So anybody who makes a donation to our charity will be able to write it off on their taxes as well. So,
wow, I'm loving this so much, because these are things that I've always wanted to ask someone running a cat cafe. And I like that this isn't a cat cafe, because this makes it even more specific and more fun for me to pick your brain about. Because I mean, as a cat owner myself too, I worry about things like, would these be indoor, outdoor cats only? I mean, you don't have to answer all these questions, because these are just what runs through my brain here, and I'm sure you get these a lot. What if there's a health issue with one of the cats during the day, and do you rotate them in and out? And how do they play throughout the day? And we mean, well, all this kind of stuff. I'm sure you had to sit through and think and be like, this is plan A, this is plan B, this is plan C, because all of them will fail.
I have answers for all of those. We're a free roam cafe. So what that means is that none of the cats will be in cages unless they need to be quarantined with some kind of sickness. Mm-hmm. We will take in all cats, whether they are outdoor or indoor. We won't be able to take in feral cats or cats with FIV. Kitty AIDS, because it spreads so easily. And feral cats don't do well with mixing with indoor cats in an open free range environment. So those are the only ones that we won't be able to take in. So yes, they will have open run of the place. So they will be able to play whenever they want. As far as any kind of vet care, all of our cats will be vetted by a local organization called PAWS. Stands for Pets Are Worth Saving. They also have, we sat down and had a meeting with a vet tech last week, actually, who put us in touch with her organization. And I wrote about this. I think, Nat, you may have read this, but basically it's going to cost us $15. We're going to get, because we're a charitable nonprofit, we get a certain discount. Discount on cats. So we would pay $15 for the cats, the death row cats, and then we have to have them vetted, which means they will be spayed, neutered. They will have heartworm, ear mites, microchipped, all of that stuff, and tested for FIV. So that is $68 it's going to cost us. So all of that is going to end up running us $83 as is. And then on top of it, we have to, account for how long they stay there and their food and their litter and all that stuff. So we do charge $100 adoption fee, which basically pays for everything that we paid for the cats. So everybody's like, well, how are you going to make money? How are you going to stay in business? We charge $10 to come in, which is the standard fare or standard rate of most cat cafes in the world that we've gone to.
That's very small, because think about they're ordering food still, and you have arcade games. There's a difference.
And our arcade games are free play. So I'm setting all of them free play. So you get free. And that's what's funny, is that I didn't realize this until we were having our conversation with the vet tech last week. And I was like, oh, yeah, they'll all be set on free play. And she's like, oh, really? And I was like, oh, shit, I didn't really push this angle, I guess. But yeah, all of the arcade games will be free. And so you can sit there for as long as you want playing arcade games. But the idea
is $10, you get in, and then you do it for as long as you want.
Exactly.
Arcades don't have a cover charge to get in, but they charge you for the coins. So this is your trade-off.
Yeah.
And you get cats, okay?
Yeah.
And so it's like,
And soda, I assume, as well. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly, because we can serve non-perishables. We're going to have a PPA license, which is a public place of amusement. So that allows us to charge a cover into getting in, which is a donation. it is a donation because we are a charity, but we can't call it a donation because then people will think, oh, well, then I don't have to pay it if it's only a donation. So we have to get a PPA only for that reason. So the PPA license, which costs $1,000, and then we also have to have them come out because we have to have a certain amount of parking spots allotted per person who comes into the place. We have to have a certain amount of square footage in the bathroom and separate bathrooms. And like, there's so many laws that go along with each one of these licenses. But yeah, one of the biggest things was like, I didn't realize that the free game was going to be such a hit, but the idea is to just drive traffic in. Yes, we understand the Catcade is a novelty. Having arcade games in Cats is a novelty. We understand that. But the idea is that if that novelty gets more people in the door to potentially adopt Cats, hey man, that's cool. You know, like if it, you know, like Cat Cafe started in Asia with the idea because a lot of the landlords out there don't allow cats in their apartment buildings, and because you know people love cats and they want to go play with cats, but they can't have them in their apartment, so they started doing cat cafes where you can go and you could do homework and you could sit there on your Wi-Fi and you know work on your computer while you have a cat on your lap. And to a niche market in this world, that is a valuable, you know, like that's valuable. That's valuable entertainment. And I know that seems really odd to a lot of people. And to me, if you would have said this to me 20 years ago, I'd have been like, what? People want to pay to go sit with cats? That makes no sense. but now that I've been in that world and I understand how all that stuff works, I'm like, oh my God, like I went to this one in Sydney when I was there last time. I talked to them and they said, yeah, we get an average of 100 people a day. And I was like, oh my God. And I think they charged 14 or 15 an hour at the one in Sydney.
An hour, as opposed to a cover.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And the idea is that it's per hour, so it circulates people in and out. Because if they didn't, people would literally sit there and fall asleep and just lay with cats all day. And that's what happens, you know, in so many places that they have to circulate people in and out. The one in San Diego, I had to wait 45 minutes. We had to wait 45 minutes just to get in. The one in Amsterdam, we were the first people there. Because we're nerds and
for the cat. Yeah, cafe.
We did. Aww. Yes, we did. And it was called Dipusen Boat. Which is funny because we went in there and we're like, oh, the Dipusen Boat. And the woman behind the counter is like, yeah, it translates literally to the pussy boat. And she gave us this look.
Oh.
This is funny. But yeah. And so what was funny is that when we were leaving, there was people outside waiting to get in because there wasn't enough room. They could only have so many people in there. And so we're not trying to be millionaires off of this. We know that, you know, basically I've always been a fairly minimalist type of person. I don't need a lot of money to survive, but I do need to survive. And so basically we are board members and we would be able to pay ourselves a living wage. So we would be the only ones getting paid. And we're allowed to, like I said, pay ourselves a living wage. So it's not going to be much at all. But if that's what it takes, like if I can keep my lights on, pay my rent and maybe order a pizza, you know, once or twice a week, like that's all that I really care about, as long as I can make this a reality, as long as I can, you know, do this idealistic thing and, you know, kind of save these, you know, cats from being euthanized, and all while making arcade games and being able to go to work and play Galaga and sit there with a bunch of cats on my lap. Do you know what I'm saying? So
before we move on quickly to another aspect of this, which is the donations and the giving, which I want to kind of tie into something I want to hype. Would you and Shelley be like giving up other priorities to do this, like other kinds of work or anything like that? Like, you know, or would, you know, it be, obviously a lot of your stuff is from home. I don't know if hers is. Would it be, you know, like this is where you would go to work every day and run the business, or not the business, but the cafe?
Yes. The cafe. To answer your question, yeah. Yes. Yes, I'd be sacrificing basically everything for this. For me, again, it seems like a natural progression for me to move from what I'm doing right now, which seems to be kind of like tapering down the amount of speakings that I'm doing, the amount of books that I'm putting out, and tapering off into something that feels also equally as fulfilling. And so, you know, I spend a lot of time at home anyways working. And so does she. She started an event company last year, and she works from home doing that as well. So both of us could easily work while we are at the Catcade, but we are both transitioning into making that our – it will absolutely be both of our priorities once it is up and running, provided that we get, you know, the adequate funding. But it's just a matter of how long that funding is going to take, because we are on our way, and it will happen. It absolutely will happen. Like I said, we looked at a spot yesterday, actually. We've been looking at new places, and we fell in love with this place, and it's perfect for our zoning. It's perfect for, well, knock on wood, but it's perfect for everything that we need. And we sat and we spoke with the real estate agent, and they are sending over a letter of interest on Monday, and which is a kind of an informal contract at first. And it's basically like where we start to kind of go what we expect and what you expect. And we're not going to compromise on this, but we'll compromise on this, et cetera. So that's an informal contract before we sign any kind of lease. So
which neighborhood?
Yeah, I was going to ask.
It is just north of Wrigley, so I believe it's in – is that Uptown over there, or is that – it's, like, right on the edge of Lakeview and, like, Uptown, actually.
Okay.
So I don't know exactly what neighborhood that is going to be considered over there. I think it's technically called Graceland West or Buena Park. It's weird. It's, like, this weird kind of, like, fake neighborhood. But it's like,
but like it's, north of Wrigleyville, just like along north of Wrigley. Kind of Clark, like as it goes like further up,
yes.
Or like,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. Yes. Between Andersonville and Wrigleyville.
Yeah. Sorry. So. For those people who are listening to this, obviously if we haven't said enough, this is taking place in Chicago, and I've spent a relatively large amount of time in Chicago and these neighborhoods. So I I'm not a local, but I can kind of pass as one in getting my way around this area when I'm there.
You can sure to pass as an American if you needed to, from how much you know.
I can certainly not pass as an American.
I mean,
but you know,
I know you have an accent, that's fine, but I'm saying you know more about like the world than I think most people do, and you do know a lot about America. So if you're looking for a travel person, Natalie's your go-to gal. I'll give you that much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a big aspect of this project, and it sort of ties into, or it's not that it ties into, I found this hype in order to tie it into this project, is the factor that it is a charitable organization that's currently got a fundraiser, so like an Indiegogo fundraiser, asking for money to help the startup costs of the Catcade. But this issue of actually, you know, putting out your hand and saying, I want to do this thing, please pay for it. Please, my community, fund this, if you know what I mean, is something that's becoming so common these days, both with charitable organizations, with, hey, I'm American and I don't have healthcare and I'm dying, or with, you know, people who just want to do something for fun, or people who have a product, like a for-profit business that they want to start. And my experience with Chris in the past and the stuff that he's been doing is, you know, not as a charity, the stuff that he's been doing to fund his life as an artist has been, there's been somewhat of a barrier in some ways in this idea of going directly to people and asking for money because of what that, you know, means to certain people and how the culture's changing. But a few years ago, there was a TED Talk done by an artist called Amanda Palmer, who is a singer for a band called the Dresden Dolls. And from this TED Talk, she got a book deal to write about the same concept, and it's called The Art of Asking. And it's basically Amanda is a person who comes from a very specific culture, very specific sort of subculture of music and art, which is like a very bohemian kind of cabaret situation. And when she was a young woman, graduated college, her like job, her quote unquote job, which is what she talks about in the talk, was a living statue. Was she was one of the people that was like dressed in a costume, standing in a square, doing a mime performance, you know, as a busker basically. And she basically talked about that and how even through that there became like a predictable way of interacting with people, and like why some people would have hang-ups about it and why some people wouldn't. And basically through that experience, because of that experience, she has come to the place that, you know, as a touring musician where like she feels comfortable basically asking one-on-one for what she needs to produce her art. And she talks a lot about how the concept of the whole that the audience doesn't pay directly for, you know, doesn't pay directly to the artist, that the audience, you know, that it's all part of a business where, you know, the audience pays a business and the artist has to get signed by a business, you know, like a label or something like that, is actually a relatively new concept in society, in how like throughout most of society, people like artists and musicians and all of those kind of things were part of the community, and that they were funded directly by the people that wanted the art, or like by particular patrons who wanted, you know, wanted to support their work. And how this concept of distance, of like, you know, fame and distance is quite new, and that it's more going back to the idea of the internet, like being able to ask people directly, being able to be kind of a self-made artist or anything like that, is about a few people loving you up close, and that being enough to kind of fund you, like Chris said, like in a way that it's not like, you know, luxury life, but it's enough for you to do that as your job, you know. And so she's written a book about that. She gave the TED talk about that. And this this concept, Amanda has been somewhat controversial in the last few years with some articles and some commentary on some of what she's been doing, because she, within her own community, was doing a lot of this stuff not in exchange for money. That she was, you know, she was inviting, you know, people to come play at concerts with her, and you know, in the exchange for them being able to pass the hat around, like, and ask the audience for money themselves, or them getting in for, you know, fans getting free tickets and you know, beer and stuff at the show in exchange for coming on stage and like contributing to the show, like playing along and stuff, which within her own community was completely accepted and completely normal. But then people on the outside, like, hey, I'm a session musician from the Boston Orchestra, and I think it's wrong that you do it like that. You know, lots of controversies about her way of operating as an artist from people outside her community. But it's still kind of working for her. She talks a lot about in the talk about like how she asks for everything. She goes on tour and asks for places to stay, like, you know, like a crowd surfing, you know, like couch surfing, you know, people bring food, all that kind of stuff. And so basically she gets by on asking her direct audience to give what they can. You know, she puts out her music for free now. She left her major label, put out her music for free with the opportunity to sign up for Patreon, all that kind of stuff. So there's this really kind of, her book is almost like a how-to guide on how to be any kind of artist and not depend on any middleman to make a living or to be supported by, you know, people who support your art. It reminds me a lot of what Chris has done over the past 10 years or so as an artist, as an author and a performer over the last 10 years, except that this situation now with the charity is obviously asking for something not for him. It's asking for fundraising. It's asking for a charitable endeavor. The book is a really good guide, I think, to people who might have had hang-ups about that kind of, like, asking, that the asking made them feel vulnerable or ashamed, or like, oh yeah, you can give me if you want, but like, no big deal. And that is something that I know Chris, if I'm allowed to speak about him, like, he's not here, that Chris has had issues with doing as when it's been for himself, if you know what I mean. That it's something that even when he came down to Australia with our tours that we did here, we charged at the door for entry to the event, which is something that he wasn't keen on at first, because everywhere else he kind of is just, he didn't think that that was like something that he was able to do for his events, and only passed the hat at the end to donate. Whereas here it was not affordable for people to, for him to fly down without there being a cover charge at the gig. And no one was ever like, no, I shouldn't do this, if you know what I mean. It was kind of an unexpected thing, but it was a shift for him. So The concepts talked about in Amanda's talk and in the book are really good for anyone who, you know, who does want to basically be supported for their art, that they think their art actually counts as a real job. But it takes even a step further when you're more motivated to do it because it's for something else, like it's for a charity or something like that, with, you know, like with what we're doing here with the Cat Cafe, the Cat Cade. But I know that issue of asking for money, like outright asking for money, is obviously a big thing that's changed. You know, you get YouTube kids being like, hey, donate to me on PayPal so I can go visit my internet boyfriend. And they're like shameless about it. And then some people who would like rather die than ever ask that. And it's something I know that Chris has had issues about in the past. So I kind of wanted to bring up the book and the talk as a concept for people to look into if anyone else has had similar issues. But I know Chris also wanted to talk about how doing this has kind of made him feel with dealing with that kind of concept.
Okay. Well, to speak on that, I guess that I need to kind of explain that while I don't feel a disconnect with the kind of like younger generation, especially millennials, where, you know, crowdfunding is a viable and legitimate way to raise money, I did grow up in a different era. And in that era, it was unheard of, you know, for you to ask money. It put you lower than somebody else. It made you put you in a position of somebody feeling sorry for you. Like, what happened to you that you need to beg for money, kind of thing. Mm. And it is something that I'm learning through kind of having friends like you guys, you know, hearing these stories and being presented with, you know, listening to Amanda Palmer talk about this. I've always said that one of the things that I like to pride myself on is that I'm constantly evolving, and where emotionally most people, most adults stop evolving in their mid 20s, you know, when they settle down, they stop going out so much, they start, you know, having a family, basically going inward instead of outward, they stop evolving, and basically that's where they stick. And I like to pride myself on the fact that I don't kind of fall into that formula. I like hanging out with younger people, listening to their opinions, being challenged about my own opinions, and hopefully evolving to become a better version of myself every year, you know, because God forbid, like I always say, like, God forbid I'm the same person I am, you know, right now than in 10 years. I hope to be a better version of myself, a more, you know, open-minded, progressive, forward-thinking person. And so I do come from that era. I do come from that era, you know, this 80s Reaganomics kind of like, what's wrong with you? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If I could do it, you can do it kind of mentality. where crowdfunding was never even a concept, much less the internet. So the concept of that is I had done one Kickstarter campaign in the past before to raise money for one of my books, because I didn't have the money to do it, but I wanted to put it out. And basically it wasn't so much of a Kickstarter as it was for you just prepaying for your book. Okay. That was what I did. I had a handful of incentives on there, but most people just prepaid for the book and then you got the book. So it wasn't necessarily a true kind of crowdfunding thing. The problem is that crowdfunding kind of crossed this kind of like, kind of this line in the sand where it kind of lost it lost a lot of credibility with so many people who are like, well, my band wants to go on tour in Europe, so will you guys pay for this, you know? You know, it's like stuff like that.
And did you see the guy? I think he I mean, I don't know how much he ended up with, but an extraordinary amount of money was raised because a random anon just made a post saying, I want to make a potato salad, period.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Potato salad guy.
I mean, I want to be potato salad guy.
So, yeah, basically what I wanted to do was we need a lot of money to make this happen. And it sucks. It sucks that we need this much money. But I've taken all the money that I have. Both of us did. My girlfriend and I, Shelley. we both took all the money that we had, and we've invested it all into this. We haven't been traveling. We haven't been doing any of that stuff. We've just been concentrating all on this, getting licenses and getting approvals and doing research and all of the stuff. We've put all of our money into this so far. Everything that we have, and we don't have much, but we have a great concept. And we have this thing that's not like, hey, I want you to pay for me to even go through school. Not that that's not a noble thing, because it is, but this is a charity. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, we're asking for, and it's a really tough thing for me to do. I'm not going to lie, again, to speak to what Nat was mentioning about how, you know, it's really difficult for me to ask for money. I can recognize that in other people. I can tell people like, no, there's nothing wrong with that. This is, you're doing something to better the world. And there's nothing wrong with asking people for that support. But when it comes to me, it's like, it's tough for me to even take that advice, just because I've been raised on this thing, and it's really tough to kind of like unlearn that. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to feel okay about that. And you know, when people say, you know, I would love to help, but, and I'm like, okay, thank you, you know, thank you so much, instead of being like, no, don't feel the need to, like, you know, don't feel the need that you should do, you know, instead of saying that, which is my initial reaction, I have to be like, no, okay, that's fine, if you can't, that's fine, that's great. But I don't want to like go above and beyond and say like, oh, no, you don't have
to. You shouldn't, you know.
Right. And I don't want to guilt anybody. But at the same time, it's like, this thing is bigger than me. It's basically, you're helping jumpstart a charity, regardless of whether it's, you know, Christopher Gutierrez, the author, or Christopher Gutierrez, the dude who was in a song, or Christopher Gutierrez, your friend. You know, at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter who is at the helm of this. Like, this is a concept. This is a charity that I would support, even if I didn't know who was running this thing. And so it is one of those really tough things where I feel guilty. I was speaking to one of my friends the other day, and she's like, well, you need to hit up all of your, you know, your famous friends, and I'll hit up all your friends who have money. And I'm like, I don't want to be that guy, because I know the lives they live, because they tell me about it. My friends who are in bands who become millionaires, they basically say, well, you know, all these people come out of the woodwork, and all these people ask you for money, and they all want you to support their thing, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy who's coming out of the woodwork, and now all of a sudden, I used to be Chris, their friend, who would hang out with them and go get coffee and eat pizza with them. And now I'm Chris, the guy who's standing there with his hand out. And it's a really tough thing for me to do. I know that I'm not that guy. I know that's not who I am. I know that I would like to think that I've proven that over the years, that I'm not that guy, that I don't just stick out my hand and ask for money. And as Nat said, it was really difficult for me to even charge, because I'd done hundreds of speakings before I went to Australia without charging for one. I would just say, you know, if you can donate, cool. If you don't, that's fine too. I know what it's like to be broke. And, but going to Australia costs a lot of money, especially with even in the interior flights. So I had to. The only way that I could make that work, the only way that I could literally even break even by going over and seeing these people and hopefully making an impact over there, was to charge, a cover charge to see me. And thankfully, everybody over there was, you know, more than happy to be more than generous to help me out. And I honestly, and I know this sounds like I'm pandering to Nat right now, but I owe a huge debt. I feel like this. And I feel like I owe a huge debt to the continent of Australia for always being so supportive, and for never giving me shit, and for only begging for me to come back. You know, like, I feel like I found my people. I feel like I found, like, the people who truly understand who I am and what I'm trying to do. In a way that I didn't really ever feel in America, to be honest with you. And so it's funny, because those were the people that I didn't want to charge, but I had to, and I felt guilty about it. And not only were they, like, more than willing to pay that cover charge, but they were, even after I got home, they were like, when are you coming back? You know, like, it was so worth it that we want you to come back again. So it's very rare that anyone that I know, you know, gets to tour internationally, much let alone go over to Australia 5 separate times. So again, I know I'm getting a little off track, but I mean,
no.
One of the things that I like to always kind of like really kind of hit on is that, like, I have this intense amount of gratitude for anyone who supports my passions and the things that I'm working on. And because I know how passionate I am, and it's really difficult to kind of like convey that to other people. So when they get it, and when they understand it, and when they continuously support you, like, I feel like this kind of overwhelming sense of like, I need to send you all the thank you cards, you know, like, and so Yeah. But to get back on the point of asking for money, it's something that I'm trying to get better with. And I have a feeling that this campaign that I'm working on right now is one of those things that are really going to help me kind of like break away from that old mentality.
Yeah. What you said about Australia is interesting to me because I'm just sort of kicking the tires on this one. But I know we have a very different culture here in what we appreciate, like, you know, the obviously the distance is a big thing. But given that the structure of the show and, you know, my planning of the shows as well is pretty intense and far in advance, and given the structure saying, hey, come out, like, you know, and even charging the door, not that we're even charging tickets in advance, like that would be even more of a sure thing, like, you know, people buying their tickets in advance. This is still only waiting for people to show up on the door and then paying as opposed to choosing to donate at the end. But just the structure of, hey, this is an event that's been planned and that you have to pay to get into adds a value, you know, adds a level of, you know, self-worth, I think, as opposed to being, oh, I'm going to be here. You can show up if you want. Like, it's not that big, like, as in, like, no obligation, no big deal. It's not really, like, it's not exactly that it's, like, playing you down or anything, but it certainly is less promoted as something with a tangible value, maybe, than something that is structured that, hey, this is an event that I've got in my calendar that I've, you know, am paying to go to kind of thing. So I don't know. Like, one of the things in the book of Amanda's is she talks about the fraud police, which is like the I'll just quote a tiny bit of it. But she was like, the imaginary, terrifying force of real grown-ups who you believe at some subconscious level are going to come knocking on your door in the middle of the night saying, we've been watching you and we have evidence. You have no idea what you're doing. You stand accused of the crime of completely winging it. You're guilty of making shit up as you go along. You do not actually deserve your job. We are taking everything away and we are telling everybody.
Oh, so my basically, God. I love that.
I think that,
you know, fraud police is a big thing for a lot of, you know, a lot of artists, obviously. And maybe, like, you know, the transition for you with the Catcade is that it's because it's not about you, there's less fraud police involved. Or perhaps that should be the mentality, especially if what we're talking about is, like, going to people and directly and saying, hey, I have something that I need funded. Would you consider helping or sharing it with other people? Because, some of what I've seen in terms of your tactic, especially with tours, like, has been more of a, yeah, like less of a wanting to bug people, less of wanting to ask directly, less of wanting to tell people how much you need it. It's more you put it up, you're like, oh, yeah, this is happening. You know, if you discover it on your own and you want to do it, you kind of leave it all up to the choice of the other person, which is understandable in a way, but it is kind of a brushing off of you either saying I don't need it that much or I'm too embarrassed or too
and
shameful
that's exactly
to actually
it.
Ask. Yeah.
And I'm glad that you noticed that because that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. And that's kind of the way that I operate is that I throw it out there and I'm kind of like, well, if you want to donate, that's cool. But again, it does. It comes off as embarrassing. It comes off as like maybe I'm not that passionate about that. Maybe I'm not putting that much effort into it and I'm just trying to see how much money I can raise. And so because of this, that's why I made my recent post of kind of explaining, hey, I want you to understand how serious I am about this. I want you to know how much effort and planning I have put into this and how far along we are actually in this campaign. And so recently I made a post kind of like explaining to the dollar, basically, how much everything was going to cost. And I'm like, this is why, you're asking for $30,000. That's a lot of money, okay? That's a lot of money. And so when I'm asking for that, this is why I've come up with this number. This is the most conservative number estimate that we have come up with based upon all of our research. And which alone, like I said, as to give you a quick example, the places that we're looking at are around $3,500 a month to rent. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's triple net. That means all of the insurance and the city taxes are included as well. And so $35, let's say per year, or $3,500 per month. And the problem is that they're going to want at least 2 months rent for security deposit plus the first month up front. Okay. So right then and there, that's, you know, $10,500, but we're not going to be able to do anything for the first, you know, at least month, because we're going to be building out the place. Basically what you're getting is what's called a vanilla box. So that means you get white walls and a floor. That's it. So what we have to build walls, we have to build windows in between the walls. We have to build, you know, enclosures for the bathrooms and whatnot. You know, there's so many walls that we need to build. And again, I can build a wall. I know how to put up drywall, but can I do it to the specifications of the Chicago building inspector that's going to be coming in and scrutinizing my work? Probably not. So I'm going to have to hire a contractor. So there's all of these things that go into that just to even open the doors. I'm not even saying to even build out anything. We have to put in non-porous floors because you can't have wooden floors, because what if the cats continuously pee on it? You know what I'm saying? It has to be concrete. It has to be sealed. And so the problem is that just to open those doors, we have to pay 4 months' rent, okay? Mm-hmm. That's not even with building anything. 4 months' rent until we open those doors and people can come in and hopefully pay their $10 cover charge. So that right there is $14,000. So when I come up with a figure of, we come up with that figure of $30,000, like that is a conservative estimate. That's a very conservative estimate. That's us scrimping by. But the idea is that, you know, I mean, once those doors open, we will be able to take in all of these animals. We will be able to be open for you to come in, to hang out, to have people have these kind of therapeutic sessions with these cats who might not be able to have cats and play free video games. So I'm trying to justify in my brain that I'm and going against everything that I've kind of grown up knowing to ask for this money, but do it in an aggressive way, doing it in an assertive way, because I'm confident in knowing what I'm doing is the right thing, if that makes sense. So that's the thing that I'm constantly telling myself. That's this mantra. I keep kind of like saying over and over again to myself, like, you're not doing this for you. You're doing this for a bigger cause. And what you're doing is the right thing. And what you're doing is you're putting more good back into the world than taking away from it. You know, you're planting, you're not harvesting. And so it's one of the things that I have to try to come to terms with. But it's funny that you noticed that, you know, so, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, of course I noticed it. I know how to read you, but it's also, you know, I think with the asking, I think, you know, not that I, you know, would necessarily get too much into the, you know, telling you how to live your life here in public and stuff. But I think in terms of the asking, especially asking people that you maybe don't want to bother, or you like, you think you're being that guy, you know, I do think there is a leg to stand on it, you know, in framing it. I think it's all a matter of how you ask, of course, you know, as opposed to, and showing that it's obviously saying something like, you know that I have been supporting myself and that I don't ask for this kind of thing. I don't ask to use this connection in this way. However, I'd really appreciate it if you took a look at this specifically, because it is actually a charity-based thing, and that I would really hope to get spread outside of just my circle. And I don't think anyone who is genuinely your friend could be bothered by being asked that, especially if you're prefacing it not with shame, but with like cards on the table. You know that this isn't coming from a bad place, or this isn't coming from a grasping place, or something like that.
Right.
Like, yeah, just sort of being honest. You know, in general. I've honestly gotten away with, it's the wrong term. I have gotten a lot of things, or achieved a lot of things, or been allowed a lot of things by asking things that no one has thought to ask. Like, you know, even if it is like not a charity thing, even if it is, I wanted to go to an event and no one, you know, and it seems to not be possible. And I've, you know, found the PR agent for that event and said, hey, is there any way I can still possibly do this? And they've said, yeah, since you found me and asked, if you know what I mean. Like, I think that there is certainly a way to do it. And I think just, you know, people can always tell if something is dodgy, or, you know, or if it's not coming from a good place. And I think that obviously that there's no really real way to claim that this charity campaign isn't coming from a good place. So I get the hang-ups, or at least I've seen them from you, you know, like I get your history with these hang-ups, but I'd certainly be taking it as far as you can, you know, if you can find it comfortable to do that.
Yeah, I want to back up what Natalie is saying there. I think that there's a difference between doing something for self-gain and doing something to save the lives of cats. That's very specifically golden, and I think that that deserves a lot of, like, precious adornment from the people who love you and who have raised you and have been there with you since day one. Like, those people need to know about this. If they don't, because, like, I was telling Natalie, like, my heart's melting knowing the story and knowing, like, that you're doing this for just cats. Like, come on. Like, it really, it's so specifically amazing that I don't see anyone having a hang up and at least hearing you out. You know, it doesn't have to be a promise of, yes, I'll push it out on said media, whatever, for you. But it could just be like, I like knowing what you're doing in life, and I made the decision to push it out my own. Maybe that's how I approach it. But hey, I'm not a business person in the same right. I know you're not looking for business advice. I'm saying,
I'll take all the advice I can get.
I'm saying you're a good person, and you deserve good things. That's where that's going.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the feedback. It's one of those things where, like, you don't really get a lot of feedback. You get people kind of donating and then saying, hey, good luck, you know? And I guess I mean, not that I necessarily need the feedback, but it's nice to hear. It's nice to hear when somebody kind of understands the passions and understands that, you know, it is something that's bigger than me. That it's not Chris's Catcade. It's not Chris's Catcade. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is this genuine shelter to help things, and it's also happens to be run by Chris and Shelley, and there also happens to be arcade games. So
yeah, so let's talk about the best part, which is the cats. Mitch, you wanted to talk as a hype about our experience with all of our cats, so that would be maybe a nice way to end before we do our close off segment, is to hype up the love of cats, which is why this is existing.
Well, my two cats are Rain and Storm, and Natalie sent me over one post that you had on Instagram, Chris, that was overprotective cat dad, and I related to it so much that I, like, screamed. I was like, ah! Yes.
Okay, continue. Tell me all about your cats. How old are they?
They're wonderful. They're four, and they're brother and sister. And I think they're a bit wacky sometimes because I think they came from feral mama who might have raised them just a little bit. But I love them regardless because they're always there, and I love having cats to come home to. So, Natalie, follow up to what I was talking to you about. I don't remember where, what podcast or whatnot. There was a medium that I saw in New York again, and this one told me, he goes, just kind of like out of the blues, he goes, why do I see you with like 20 cats? And I was like, no, I have two. That's plenty. And he goes, no, but I see you with 20 cats.
To which he called up. I would take that as a compliment. I'd be like, that's awesome. Tell me when this is going to happen.
Well, I mean, to me, like, I love my two cats. I just can't appreciate and give the attention to more than two cats, because as soon as I have more than just that, I feel so guilty to, like, not be able to pay attention or do what I need to do. Like, I hate going on vacations, as many pet owners do, because you're like, okay, my cat is there alone. Like, I have a friend seeing them, but it's not me. And that's the overprotective cat dad thing coming in. No, then the medium went on to say, he goes, you need to always have cats in your life. I know that. And I mean, it was kind of, this guy, as mediums are, was very freakishly, like, right about a lot of stuff. And this was something that he was very pointed about. He was like, you need cats. Like, you're not just a pet person, you're a cat person, because they need you and you need them. And it just made me so happy. I was like, well, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So,
Natalie, as I understand, you have just one fox. Is that correct? Along with your three cats?
I have no foxes now. The fox is at the fox rescue because our landlord had changed. But we have three cats.
You have three cats.
Now.
Three. There were only two when I was there.
I know, Chris. I know. It is completely... so we have two cats, all of which came by kind of semi-accident. Two which came from rescues. One One was from one rescue that was like evicted, like it was like someone's rescue in there, like they, you know, they were a person who got cats out of shelters and they were evicted. And then one which was from a feral cat community that was like caught as a kitten, like he was like, oh, we've noticed this cat community and there's this one kitten that's like new and it keeps like coming near people, so they think it was like a dumped kitten from like a Christmas present. They're just, oh, just like let it go with the other cats, and they basically caught him and put him in a rescue. And then we've had those ones for like several years, like 3 years or something. And they're about, yeah, like one was a tiny kitten, and then one was like 18 months when we got him. And they're called Gus and Julian. Gus came with his name, and he's pure white with a fucked up eye because he had some cat disease in the shelter. And then Julian got named. He took like 4 months to get a name that stuck with him. He's named after King Julian from the Madagascar children's movies, like the crazy lemur, if you've ever
seen. He likes that to move it, move because, it.
Yeah. There's something about him that is like that. And then we very recently, like a couple of months ago, Leo was, there was a heat wave here in Sydney, like very, very hot, like 40 degrees Celsius, which is, I don't know, 105 or something. And yeah. She found this stray cat in the street between our house and the train station that was like anorexic and like fainting, basically like super, super, super crazy thin and like tottering around and falling over. And she got very upset, and like she came home, and then she went back and it was still there. And so she brought it home, and then we found out like that it was a cat that had been dumped there a couple of years ago. Like it belonged to a house, or the people at least in a house fed it. And left, and then just left it there. And then some other people in the neighborhood, I guess, fed it, but it started getting really thin and sick. And some international students who had been renting in the street had been feeding it. And we kind of, because we put up posters, people were like, yeah, we know what cat that is, but sort of not really ours. So we have ended up with this cat that was like deathly thin. Leo, you know, once, you know, took it to the vet, said, hey, we found this cat, can you help? And they were like, no, you know, we can't really do anything with it when you don't officially own it. And then we had to go back and say, oh, we found out that it was actually dumped and we are taking responsibility for it. And she is pure black and she looks like a little witchy cat. And we called her Emily because she needed like an old lady kind of name.
Yeah.
And she turned out she had like a thyroid problem, which is why she wasn't keeping any food, like that she was like very, very thin. And so she's on medication for that. And now she lives in our back room and laundry because she makes the other cats very upset. So we have different zones of cats.
Yeah.
She would be an ideal cat cafe situation cat, in that she really is quite happy to be around anyone, and that she's not intimidated by much, and she'd be quite happy with any owner, if you know what I mean. Like, so we do hope to rehome her when she's a bit fatter. Julian, the youngest one, who is the big, massive, brute kind of cat, is terrified of her. He cannot handle it. He's like a big baby. Oh. So he's really anxious. He would not do well with any other owner, but Emily would be like a great one for rehoming if, you know, in that kind of situation. But yeah, Gus and Julian are some of the funniest cats I've ever seen. Like, I've had cats before, and I like cats, but we sit around and just scream at these cats, like scream laughing at the weird things that these particular the two boys do. They're so crazy and they're so weird. They're very active. They do really weird things with food. Like, it's just, they're so nuts. But three cats is a lot here.
It's stressful.
Yeah.
Well, that's where 20 cats? I'm like, how are you doing a cat cade? I can't wrap my mind around more than just two. And now like taking on that sounds stressful. Oof.
Well, I have three cats as is in a one bedroom apartment with my girlfriend. So we're kind of like accustomed to the chaos. But as far as the cat cade goes, we can only have X amount of cats per square footage. So I think that our max is going to be 20, but we'll know more once we build that out. So.
Wow. Oh, God. I, like, need to visit Chicago more than I ever had, because I need to see Danielle, because I've not seen her yet in Chicago. I had a really horrible layover there once. It was for 3 days, and I missed a funeral coming back in a giant snowstorm coming from New York to Denver. I got stuck in Chicago, and I was miserable for missing the funeral, and I didn't do anything in Chicago, so I need a better experience is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you really do. here's a decent airport to get stuck in, though, to be fair. But not for 3 days and not to miss a funeral. Oh.
No, that would be worse. No, God. Yeah. No, no. Do not do that. cats are awesome, and I'm so happy that we're all cat people, because I find that also the most kindred spirits of mine are ones that appreciate having cats as pets as well. It's kind of like a thing in my family, like... It runs on one side of the family very strongly that it's just in our genes, and it's always just been a thing in my life. It's so, like, I think you two might relate to this, maybe, if your family has had cats throughout your life too, that it's just, it's such a natural and like a thing of life. Like, it's almost to the point where I don't feel like I appreciate them as much as I should from the fact that I've become so used to having pets as cats. And now that I'm just to the point where, I'm consistently reminding myself, like, you need to love on them 100%, because the worst part about owning something you love is thinking about ever seeing it go. And I've never really had to do that. I'm lucky. I still have, like, childhood cats somehow, because I got them when I was, like, oh, I'm going to say, like, 10 or 12. I don't know how I'm going to deal with that one day, because I'm still, like... I'm, like, too stupidly smitten and in love to think of, like, the passing, the next... I don't really know. That'll be a whole other podcast episode where I'll just be, like, how you get over your cat passing. Because I don't know, honestly, because it's just such a strange territory for my brain. But regardless, I'm such an overprotective cat dad to the... There's this little, I wonder if either of you two have this. There's this little video camera where you can watch your cats 24/7, and you can talk and they'll hear it and they'll come to the camera and say hi, and when you're on vacation or at work, and just, I want to get it. I think I'm going to, because I'm that obsessed. I really am.
God, how many places have your cats lived with you, Mitch? Like, how many apart, like, different cities?
Different cities has been 3, if we're Denver, Seattle, and Anaheim. But then apartments is like 6. So I've gone on 3 or 4, I lost track, cross-country trips with them. And I survived all. I don't know how, but we got through together. It's been a lot. I don't suggest driving with cats that aren't used to it. You probably need to teach them that as a kitten, because when they're adults, it's a very stressful experience for them, and I feel so bad. Like, it breaks my heart to see them stressed out in the car. I don't give them, like, any, like, calm down medication, because I've heard that that just makes it worse for them, even though they look calmer. So I pretty much just, like, we hash it out together, you know, we survive it together. And it's actually to the point where it limits where I want to drive to where I'm moving to next, if I ever am, because I'm like, the cats can't handle more than one night in a hotel. So it's like, they're the thing. They are my thing. And if I didn't have this thing, I would be like, okay, no, who am I though?
Yeah. Well, that is all very, very nice. We might do our question of the day now, because it's kind of related to that. So just to close up, Chris, we just do a couple of little segments. We get either our guest or the lead host. This week it'll be you, if you can wing it as the guest, to do a 2 truths and a lie to us. So you know that game where you say 3 things that you pretend are all true and we guess which one is the lie. And we do a question of the day from someone who's submitted a question, where we all answer it, and then we close off, basically. So, question of the day, I actually got our friend Chris and I have a mutual friend called Megan Bentel, who has been on this podcast before. She has came on as our when we did our podcast about the US election. So she basically helps Chris with his events in the UK in the same way that I help in Australia, and we have been very good friends for over a decade. But she has taken some long drives across America with myself and some long drives across America with Christopher as well. And so she submitted the question saying, what's the weirdest thing that you've ever done or that's happened to you on a long solo drive? And I think she said that as opposed to like on a tour, if you know what I mean, like on a bus tour or something, Chris. So yeah, who has an answer for that? Mitch, you have done your, I know you've done your cross-country drive several times with or without cats, like to go to the East Coast and stuff like that.
I think I'm up to like 10, yeah.
Yeah.
So, honestly, I have to tie these two. I can't pick just one. One time I drove straight from Denver to Orange County, which I think is like 14 or something hours, and I just did it all in one shot. And I'm not a caffeine drinker, but I had Red Bull because I was not going to make it. But the first thing I did to kind of wake myself up that worked was I was an hour outside of Anaheim still, and I just started blaring Taylor Swift's Welcome to New York.
Oh, God.
So loud, with the windows open, so the wind's in your face. It's cold. You're like, you're feeling it. And I'm just shouting, Welcome to New So that was one. Another is that when I was first moving all the way from New York to Los Angeles, I got very slap happy with my best friend, Michaela, doing this drive, because that was like five nights or something crazy. And it came to the point where we developed some strange, like, psychological tics together, where I don't know why, but we would kind of adapt to the area that we were in. So let's just say we were in like Alabama, we would feel the need to speak like an Alabanian would, I suppose, to our own mindset. And we would even go around and, if we took a rest stop, we would pretend to be the people from that area, trying to tap their accents. We were strange. Like, we also had this thing where, we, once again with the windows, we wanted to keep the windows open. We were going like 75, 80 sometimes miles per hour, Natalie. So I'm not sure the kilometer transition there, but regardless, we would keep the windows open to the point where it'd be so loud and unpleasant. But then if you close the windows, you'd miss it so much because your brain's so in the mode where you like need the loud, obnoxious sound of the windows in your ear all day. I don't know. Like, solo drive or friend drive, however that answered your question, I've done so much weird shit in my drives. You learn who you are on these kind of drives. It's true. Like, another Goofy movie or whatever that one is, that's right. That's a thing. Like, go and find yourself, drive across the country, and go blare Welcome to New York and see how you feel. That's the best advice I can give you.
Oh, my God. I myself don't drive on my own. I have been in a passenger in many, many drives, but I don't know. I'm trying to think. In the States, we accidentally drove into Canada once by accident, so that was interesting. Oh. Going from, if you're in Detroit, there's like an underground, like a highway or a passageway that's like, you start driving and you're in Canada, like you're at passport control, and we're like, this was not what we were trying to do. And so we like suddenly got stuck, and one of my friends had like pepper spray, and apparently like you can't take pepper spray into Canada. And I don't know, it was all very like weird, and I was like half asleep, and I was like, what's happening? Oh, we're at the border. Okay, why? I also slept on the floor of that person's car. Like, I mean, like not like across the back of the seats, like while we were driving, like outside of the seat belt, like in on the floor between the seat, because she had a weirdly flat, like with no like footwells, floor of the car. So that was quite strange. I have not done too much long distance driving, as I said, because I'm not a driver myself. Chris and I once drove one of the longest drives in Australia, which is from Adelaide to Melbourne through like rural countryside that was like very dead and strange, but that's kind of all a blur. But Chris, I know you have got like 5,000 million of these. But yeah, is there anything ever had to do with long drive with your cats?
With my cats? Generally, no. They usually stay in a little cage and they get freaked out when you drive them. But the only thing that I could really think of is, I have a bunch of different stories because I've crisscrossed the United States, you know, probably on a fairly regular basis for the past, I don't know, 20 years. But one of them was I was driving down to St. Louis to do, I believe, my second date or my fourth date, I believe, of a speaking tour. And I was driving and just zoning out, you know, doing like 80, you know, down the expressway to get there. And I was making great time. And all of a sudden, I see a goose flying. And it was crazy because I saw it in the distance, and then all of a sudden it goes, and it like, it's weird when you see it in the distance, and I'm like, man, that goose is flying really low. And all of a sudden when you're doing 80, it speeds up exponentially as you get closer to it. And it just closer you get, it gets so much faster, and it smashed into the windshield of my rental car and shattered the entire window. and it rained like windshield glass in the car, but it hit on the passenger side. So it rained all in on the passenger side. And I was like, oh shit. And I pulled over and it didn't hit me. It hit the passenger side. So all the glass rained in on that side. And I got out and I actually filmed it, and it's on YouTube. It's actually on YouTube, and you can see the outline of the duck's beak on the windshield. Like, you can see it. It's something like the dust or whatever, it hit it, and I couldn't find it, but it was clearly probably not alive. And yeah, so I couldn't do anything, and needless to say, I couldn't drive, and I was one of, I want to say, two speakings that I ever missed out of all of my speakings. And I couldn't be there because I had to get a new rental car. So I had to spend the night in some tiny little airport while they came, picked up my car, and then dropped off a new one. And it was a hot mess. But yeah, so that's my driving. That's one of my fun driving ones.
That's horrible.
I mean,
crazy.
It's one of the more memorable ones.
I'll give you that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll never forget. Yes, that's right. I mean, the time the goose hit your... I'm going to be nervous. I mean, yeah. I already kind of am, because that's a thing. Like, Natalie, as your driver, I think if and when you were ever to drive, I think you know. That's kind of like you're always afraid of something, just it's going to hit your windshield. I don't know why. And I think that your story is giving that phobia a lot of, like, credence here. And I'm kind of scared now to, like, go anywhere. Like, what if that goose comes after me? What if he's still around?
Yeah, that is quite crazy. A few of my friends have done some really crazy long drives in Australia, including with the fox rescue people, Mitch, but yeah, I have not done too many.
You mean with fox in the car?
Yes, one of my good friends has done drive with three baby foxes in the car and had to get them into a motel overnight and stuff like that.
Oh my god.
Okay. So we'll quickly go, Chris, if you would like to give us a two truths and a lie for us to guess about either your life, your project, about whatever you want, it can be literally about whatever you want. And then we will close off and let you go, because I think you have to go now.
I do. Okay. I was just thinking about this. Okay. My two truths and a lie. I have never drank a full beer. I have never been skiing. And I have never eaten spaghetti while driving across the country while driving.
Natalie, I think I should go first, because you're going to inform me too much, because you probably already know.
Okay.
You've never been skiing.
I've never been skiing. That's right.
Were you going to guess that, Natalie?
That's my lie.
Oh, so that's the lie.
Skiing is the lie.
So you have been skiing. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is
skiing. That's
no, I've never been skiing.
I was correct in my assumption. That's the one.
Yes.
It's weird where you're like, yeah.
I'm confused now.
The incorrect fact was.
And it was kind of like a double negative, but yes.
Yes. He's never been skiing. That is correct. That's the best way of saying that.
Okay. So my guess is that it's true that you've never drunk a full beer.
That's true.
It's true that you've never been skiing. Is that what we're saying?
I guess.
Wait, hold on.
The double negative is really getting me.
It's messing me up too. Hold on. I've never drank a beer. Hold on, that's true. But I've never been skiing. Oh yes, I did. I messed this up. Yes, I ruined it. I ruined your joke or your.
So you should
I'm
have
sorry.
Been saying. Oh no, Natalie, you're right. He should have been saying that I have been skiing, and then I would have called that out and saying, "No, you have not."
So exactly.
That's the lie. Okay. Yeah, I'm
the worst at this. Clearly.
Okay. And yes, you have, I think that you have eaten spaghetti while driving across the country. Is that,
yeah,
is that true?
Because I one time took a picture of myself, just, I was driving through Texas, and I was like driving with the cruise control on and like a plate of spaghetti in my lap while I was eating spaghetti. And I took a picture of myself and I sent it to a friend, and they were like, "What the hell are you doing?" And I'm like, "Dude, there's no one out here." And they're like, "But what if like a deer runs out?" And I'm like,
Mitch, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When you did your 14 hours drive singing Welcome to New York, did you actually get out of the car at any point at any rest stations?
No, not for an extended period of time. Literally just for gas.
Did you go to the bathroom in a receptacle inside your car?
I don't need to, because I, oddly enough, can drink as much water as I need to and never have to on road trips. I'm the best road tripper ever. I'm, like, professional about it, because it just, the urge shuts down. My brain's like, we're road tripping, we're driving. So I was just doing it. Like, I'd be like, okay, 14 hours. I don't know what's wrong with me. But, I mean, I promise I stayed properly hydrated and fed, but it just...
That's okay. I'm just curious. Chris has an infamous history with his receptacles.
Oh, going to the bathroom.
Oh my God.
I think I did it, like, a week ago.
Oh, really?
I always have to... Like, listen, I pee a lot because I drink a ton of water, right? And so, yeah, especially when you're on long trips, like, I always keep, like, just, like, a Gatorade bottle or any kind of bottle next to me so I could pee in it. And,
while driving?
Yeah. All the time. Well, you set the cruise control and then you kind of angle yourself up and you just kind of angle and keep one leg rested on the driver's steering wheel so it keeps going straight. And yeah,
I could
all the time.
I could not. I would not. That's very scary for a lot of reasons.
Oh, it's definitely scary.
You live life on the edge, what can I say?
I do.
Okay, we will finish up now. Basically, Chris, if you want to tell us where we can find you and where we can find the campaign, and then we will, we'll close up.
Okay, well, for me, you can go to my website, which is just deadxstop.com. That is where you can find all of the things that I do as far as my books and my writing and all that kind of stuff. That's just my home base. But for what we're doing with the Catcade, it's thecatcade.org. And right there you can find all of our kind of like a little brief kind of about us and a donation to our PayPal. We're also on Indiegogo right now as well. But it would be cooler if you did it, the donation through our website, because then that way they don't take their cut. Thecatcade.org and deadxstop.com. That's the stuff that I do.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, very, very good to have you. So thank you for that. We will push out those links to everyone we can. So you should be doing that as well. I actually have another friend who does Kitten Rescue LA. So another friend of mine from the one of our TV writer friends, she does a lot of stuff with Cat Rescue as well. So we've done a few Cat Rescue promotions in our time, honestly.
Awesome.
So basically, thank you for joining us. If anyone would, you know, like to send in a question for us to answer on air in the future and be the question of the day, they can send us an ask on our notaboutthe.weatherpodcast.tumblr. They can reach out on the Twitter or Facebook. And if you've enjoyed these podcasts so far, you can give us 5 stars on iTunes so that we look legit. So just to finish up and say goodbye to everyone, we will finish up with our traditional closing, which is our peaceful high conclusion. So this week I have found one specifically about cats, and I'll link to the source. Unfortunately, Ariana was not able to write us a niche one about the episode as she was not on. But here we go. So to close, just a sentiment about some cats. Aromatic trash. You forgot to close the lid. Remnants of taco. I feel we can all relate to that.
Oh,
so
my God, you don't even know.
So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Mitch. And thank you for allowing me to read a haiku from the perspective of a cat. We will get this out. And yes, so you can donate to the Catcade as an ongoing project or as part of the campaign, which I assume has an end date as well.
Yes, we have 24 more days, but thank you guys so much for having me. I appreciate you letting me run my mouth and letting me rant and listening to me. And thank you so much for having me. It means a lot.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. All right. I will let you go. So we'll all say bye and then you should log off. So bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Take care, Mitch.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.